Ladies and gentlemen, to the November 4th Election Day edition of the San Luis Obispo County Board of Supervisors meeting. We do hope those of you in the audience and those listening have voted or will vote at your earliest opportunity. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like a little bit of assistance hearing proceedings in chambers, we do have hearing assist devices stored at the end of the dais, and you're welcome to pick one up. And with that, if you would all please rise and join me in the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Madam Clerk, when you're ready, changes to today's agenda, please.
Addendum to item number 39. The subject of this item is being amended to read as follows. A hearing to consider an appeal by Avila Valley Advisory Council of the Subdivision Review Board's approval of tentative parcel map CO14-0021, development plan, coastal development permit SUB2013-0054, and adoption of the proposed mitigated negative declaration pursuant to the California Environmental Quality Act to allow subdivision of a 6,000-square-foot parcel into two 3,000-square-parcel-foot development parcels and construction of two single-family units for vacation rentals located on Colony Lane within the community of Avila Beach, District 3. Additionally, due to legal timing constraints, staff is adding two attachments, Attachment 4, Revised Site Plan, and Attachment 5, Draft Minutes to the October 6, 2014 Subdivision Review Board hearing. Requirements of the Brown Act have been satisfied as this notice was posted prior to the 72-hour notice of requirement.
Very good. Thank you, Madam Clerk. That brings us then to our consent agenda. I do have a number of requests to speak. We'll start with Richard Margetson, followed by Chuck Sasanian.
Richard Margetson, this is on 2 and 3, the retrofit ordinances for Los Osos. I would hope that these would be pulled for further discussion so these don't get adopted as they are on the 25th. I know that's your hearing date, but the first one on the retrofit upon sale ordinance, they're asking to discontinue it because everyone in the prohibition zone will eventually have to retrofit their toilets in order to hook up to the sewer. That's at least a year and a half away. Discontinuing this program is not helping the water conservation issue in Los Osos and the basin issue. It's not. This is another opportunity to save water in Los Osos. If you discontinue it, you basically have eliminated that additional opportunity. The other ordinance, the retrofit to build ordinance, I'm going to read one of the findings or one of the reasons. Since the inception of the retrofit to build program in 2008, 10 of the 27 water conservation certificates have been issued to vacant properties in the prohibition zone. Property owners have stated that the primary reason for obtaining certificates was to ensure that they have water for their vacant lots at the time the wastewater project is completed. Some property owners have expressed concern that the certificates will not be valid in the future on prohibition zone lots. Now here's the operative sentence. Additionally, with the adoption of the basin management plan, lots in the prohibition zone will benefit from supplemental water through implementation of the basin management plan and will not need a water conservation certificate in the future. Really? Where in the basin management plan is one of the top initial priorities to look for a supplemental water source? It's not in there. Mr. Gibson keeps telling everyone that he's disappointed that the basin management plan has taken so long to get to the point of being implemented and the court to approve it. We're getting close to that. It's been years. But now we turn around and we eliminate the retrofit upon sale ordinance And we are banking on a supplemental water source to change the retrofit to build ordinance? Really? Are we really concerned about Los Osos Water Basin, or are we not? I think that's the question for this board to answer. And I'd like to know if the Los Osos CSD, which is one of the major water purveyors, had any input into these ordinances.
Timetable, no. It's not even one of the recommended actions. So I think you're just premature, and the sustainability group will be taking a good hard look at these proposed ordinance changes. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sasanya Mazzone, followed by Julie Tacker.
Good morning, Lindy Owen from Los Osos. This retrofit program that you have been trying to work out, we're the guinea pig or the lab rat, I guess, for retrofit out in Los Osos, and it's been a painful experience watching many transformations and failures to really address the serious problems, but more just slap a, here, we've tried to do a fix for you, this is going to have to work. And ultimately, it is about saving our basin, which, again, while Rome burns, the players are talking about things still. 7 years into our basin management program, we have nothing to show for it except a lot of lawyer bills. So what I wanted to address, kind of like what Mr. Margetson and Mr. Sasina both spoke about, what supplemental water, Mr. Gibson? I go back and recall that you promised that the 500 empty lots that can't develop because we'll have a sewer, but we will not have any water for them. Therefore, why would they sign up? Why would they do a 218 to sign up for a sewer connection when they still won't see a future of building any time that we know of, because we're dependent on our basin. Our basin is being destroyed by neglect, so we're kind of in this circle, I don't know, silly circle. But number four on your Title 19, just allow a one-time transfer of previously issued water conservation certificates from a vacant lot to a vacant lot outside of the PZ. Are we trying to save a basin, or are we just trying to save some developers the chance to build, even, you know, when the truth was that they were told they would build after the sewer went in? They were not told that we had a water basin problem, and the realtors still do not tell buyers in Los Osos that we have a level 3 severity and we have a crisis. So these retrofit programs are just dressing on the window, or whatever they call it. They're not being very effective, and I want Mr. Gibson to please tell my community and those 500 empty lot owners, where exactly is that supplemental water going to appear from in 2 years when we go online, which is what you promised?
Ms. Tacker, followed by Dr. C. Height.
Good morning. I am Julie Tacker from Los Osos. And this program, these programs have saved water. And I think your staff reports should reflect what kind of savings we've accumulated over this amount of time since 2008. Yes, there were some hiccups in the beginning, but I think those have been ironed out. But if you just, my guesstimate is that some 20 acre feet has been saved. This is done by the private sector. It's very expensive. Some $25,000 per acre foot is the cost of this water. Very expensive. But the private sector is doing it. To discontinue anything is ridiculous. The conservation technology is improving year after year. So there's water left on the table, so to speak, in that the devices that can be put in upon sale or upon new development, there's that incremental savings by changing out a toilet. The 0.8 gallon flush is available now. Your ordinance only requires the 1.28 toilet. So there's water to be saved yet again if we continue these programs. I think we're on the right track. I think it does need to be ironed out further. I know that the planning department went to Napomo and had a meeting with, sat in on their the NCSD meeting last month and explained how the program worked to their board, to their community. I believe that the planning department needs to come to Los Osos CSD, where the meeting is better attended, televised, and again, explain the programs so that everyone's on the same page and we know how to refine it, perhaps. But I think, I know the planning department did go to LOCAC, and the advisory council is poorly attended, not televised, and I don't even think it was agendized very well for optimum participation by the public. So it couldn't hurt to bring it.
Empathy. And this was a very, very important celebration. You know, it persevered even through rain. It was important for people to come out and have an outlet for their grief, a positive outlet. And I want the county to consider that when Wilshire Hospice comes up on your agenda, there is more to supporting your nonprofits, your outside agencies, than just writing a check. You can support in other ways, as we saw when Supervisor Arnold came and actually participated, because what is important about this kind of work, this kind of an outlet for people's grief, is that it is more positive and productive than alcohol or drugs, and that includes antidepressants. In the long run, it will save the county in money to support Wilshire Hospice, to support the new Day of the Dead celebration, and I believe that it will take place. It will be an annual event now because of the great success that they had. It is important because in the long run, the county will be paying out more in expenses for people who have no outlet to deal with their suffering and with their grief. And I guess in the future when I come forward, I need to wear a costume to telegraph my position so that our chair understands that I'm here to speak about something positive in this type of support. And what should be known by the chair in this county is that I do support nonprofits with my art and with my advocacy. And I really enjoyed the opportunity to do this. I put my full self wholeheartedly into this. This is what I do. And I really enjoyed supporting Wilshire Hospice and being a participant in the Day of the Dead. And I really want to personally thank the county for putting this on your agenda and giving it some importance. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Height. Mr. Brown.
Mike Brown representing CoLab. Item 4 on your consent calendar would confirm an apparent policy that the Planning Commission would not be involved in the referral of particularly the long-range or five-year capital improvement plan, plus projects that pop up on an annual basis and are added in the referral process under the guise that your board could actually be the Planning Commission for some things or everything. And we think you ought to go the other way. The capital improvement plan is extremely important. For example, your complete communities study and the financial shows that to do your smart growth plan and Oceano, Napomo, Templeton, and San Miguel would cost about $409 million. We think that the Planning Commission should be expressly involved in the review of the proposed capital program, should integrate and help provide independence and ideas for the board. Separately, item 14 requests that Supervisor Gibson be reappointed as the CSAC representative, and that needs to be expedited because he currently serves on the executive committee, and the CSAC has requested that this appointment, if he wants to continue, be made in advance of the annual conference. And the problem with this is that this will not then be done unless it has to be redone with all the other committee and commission and assignments that you do as part of your organizational meeting in January, which seems too bad. You know, back when Proposition 30 to raise the state income tax and sales tax, Supervisor Gibson, as your representative, put the county on the record as supporting those. There was no discussion or vote here on that major piece of policy, and we think you ought to be a lot more careful about these assignments and the legislative program.
One more request to speak. Kathleen Bellefontaine on behalf of the Commission on Aging. Ms. Bellefontaine.
I'm here to speak about number 13, and I'm the chairperson for the Commission on Aging, and I just want to thank Ms. Arnold for your appointment. I'm very happy about having Shirley join us, and also a thank you to all of the supervisors.
The potential consideration of a couple of small modifications to that, because if we don't do it now, we might have to reintroduce it when we get to the hearing on the 25th. And so one of the things, as I discussed this with staff, that might go one way or might go another is a standard for urinals in commercial buildings, of all things. One of them is whether we should require as a standard waterless urinal. So I'd like the record to show that that might be a topic of discussion when we get to the full hearing. And second is to the question of transferring conservation certificates away from lots in the prohibition zone. I'd like to put on the record that we might have a discussion of whether we should do that under the when there is a county drought emergency drought declaration in place, or whether we should do that at all. So with those two things on the record, I'm understood from council that we would have a little flexibility to discuss those items when we get to the full hearing. Happy to take any questions or comments from colleagues on that. Seeing none, I would entertain a motion on consent absent item 21.
So moved. Second.
Thank you, Mr. Meacham and Mr. Hill. Madam Clerk, a roll call vote.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Ms. Ray?
Yes.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes.
And Mr. Gibson?
Yes. And Mr. Vice Chair, if you'd chair the meeting for item 21.
Absolutely. Now we're going to get something done.
Yeah. One little thing.
Item number 21. Supervisor Ray.
Yesterday I asked some clarifying questions on this that we couldn't get in the meeting, so I just thought I would give Mr. Buckshy the chance to answer my questions. This is with regard to the internal loan that we're going to do to help the airport refinance. And so my only question was that it mentions that there would not be a payment for the first year. Can you explain how that's going to work and how the interest plays into that? Because it wasn't clear in the staff report.
Yes, I can, and our auditor, controller, treasurer, tax collector is here to offer additional detail if needed. The first payment would be due in approximately a year. However, it would accrue interest over that time frame at a rate that's noted in the report, which is, I believe, roughly 0.5% above what the treasury earns.
Okay, that's good enough. Thank you.
Do you have anything to add to that at all?
No, thanks for your consideration.
Okay, thank you very much. Any further questions?
No, I move to approve item 21.
I'll second.
Roll call, please.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Ms. Ray?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
And Ms. Arnold?
Yes.
Okay, you can come back.
Mr. Meacham, I realize I didn't avail myself the opportunity to talk about the county as a landlord, but, you know, maybe some other time. With that, then, let me first recognize Madam Clerk Recorder.
You need to do the presentations before you...
Oh, presentations first. Well, let me ask Ms. Rodewald, would you like to speak on your last election day? I would be happy to get you back to your...
It's kind of nice sitting in here, actually. I don't know what's happening across the hall or outside.
Yeah, you want to...
Good morning, Board. Julie Rodewald, County Clerk Recorder. Today is election day. With polls are open. I'm glad to announce that. That's always a tense moment when we get there at 5:30 and wait for those polls to open. We have about 44,000 vote-by-mail ballots back. That leaves about 52,000 remaining to get turned in today. So those do need to be dropped off at a polling place anywhere in our office, in our county, or at one of our offices. Our drive-by drop-off this morning has been very busy, so they're doing their part in collecting part of those 50,000 ballots that are outstanding. Tonight we have ballots, we have about 40,000 ballots, a little over 40,000 ballots that are counted, ready to be released after 8 o'clock tonight, and those will be available at slovote.com. We should finish up hopefully before midnight tonight, get the final results out to people before then. If voters have questions, they can go to our website at slovote.com, or we've got staff standing by answering phones at 781-5228, and hopefully everybody gets out and votes today.
Very good.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Rodewald, and good luck.
Thank you.
With that, first I've been informed by Ms. Douglas Schatz of our HR department that item 32 is going to be pulled today because the recipients of the 30-year recognitions are both working out in the field, and so we will reschedule that some other time. And thus, I would entertain a motion on presentations item 29 through 31.
So moved.
Second.
Thank you, Mr. Hill and Mr. Meacham. And Madam Clerk, a roll call vote, please.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Ms. Ray?
Yes.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes.
And Mr. Gibson?
Yes. The first one?
To helping families and to support the families that provide these homes, the San Luis Obispo County Department of Social Services is acknowledging National Adoption Month to raise awareness about the need for adoptive homes for local children and join other organizations to celebrate adoptive families in our community. This effort, along with similar celebrations in all 50 states and the District of Columbia, will offer children the chance to live with loving, healthy, permanent families when they cannot live with their birth families, and encourage other dedicated individuals to make a powerful difference in the lives of a child through adoption. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the Board of Supervisors does hereby proclaim November as National Adoption Month in San Luis Obispo County, and in doing so, urge all citizens to join a national effort to raise awareness about the importance of adoption. Christopher, would you please come?
Thank you. Thank you, Supervisor Hill and Supervisors. A revise to one of those numbers, we actually have 68 adoptions last fiscal year, which was 15 more than the previous fiscal year. Araya Jones, our foster parent liaison, is passing out calendars that feature many of the children who are looking for permanency in their life, and this has been an annual pursuit of ours for the past several years. Currently today, there are 323 children in foster care. And the goal of the department is always to try and reunify those children as quickly and wherever safely possible. And we do a fairly good job of that. But on average, 5 to 6 children each month are adopted each month, giving us an annual total last year of 68 adoptions. Currently, the department does a really good job on being measured on a national standard of 37% adoptions needing to occur within 24 months of a child's removal. And that 37% is a national standard, and California struggles to meet it. However, for the past 3 years, San Luis Obispo County has met and exceeded that standard for the past 3 years. And last year, we actually came in at 61% timely adoptions, which is a remarkable achievement and effort, and it's an effort that is really only obtainable by work with the community and community partners. So today I'd like to honor some of those partners, some of whom have sent designees today in our audience. And as I call your name or your agency, please rise so we can acknowledge you.
One of those is Kinship Center. Aspiranet. Family Care Network. Family Connections Christian Adoption. Pathways. Cuesta College Family or Foster and Kinship Care Education Program. Martha's Place. County Mental Health. County Council and the court system. And all members of Department of Social Services, including David Platt, who supervises our adoption workers, many of whom were able to make it today, and some of our licensing members. So thank you. In addition, the department clearly could not do this without people from the community adopting or doing guardianship for our children. And we are pleased to say anywhere between 45 and 50% of the adopters tend to be relatives or families adopting their own family members. So that's quite an achievement, too. So thank you very much, and I will pass this on for a photo opportunity.
Excellent.
Bring them all your partners.
Yeah, why don't you bring the whole crew?
Sort of fill in here. Yeah.
We don't bite.
Not until the afternoon.
Unless we haven't had lunch.
Yeah.
Might have to make a little row.
All right, I think we may have to do two rows here.
Just a row in front to get everybody in there.
Squeeze it in.
Thank you for all your work.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you.
As this great group of people disperse from the dais here, let me thank them on.
What we do is we meet monthly. We have almost 40 representatives on the council. They represent the social service agencies that assist the most vulnerable in our community, seniors and the adult disabled. We have a speaker on a monthly basis, and we try to make that speaker be one who brings us new information that we might not have otherwise. We would invite all of you to attend those meetings. They are open not only to you, of course, but to the general public as well. We support one another, and so often situations are brought up, we're discussed, and we actually are able to solve a problem at the table, so that's kind of fun. The council members' collaboration avoids duplication of services, and it strengthens the ability of the agencies to meet emerging needs. As in years past, the major areas of concern center around shelter, food, transportation, and fraud. And, of course, we're all aware now of the grandma and grandpa fraud that's created some problems in our own community. We've had two people that I'm aware of that actually lost money as a result of this. And the police department is kind about keeping us informed, and we, of course, transmit that information out to the public. Goals for the coming year are increasing our membership and participation, continued monitoring of AB 109, support of the agencies working in those areas of greatest concern, monitoring of behavioral issues, mental health and addiction, support of culturally appropriate services to the LGBT seniors and adults with disabilities, support of improved quality of life for all seniors and disabled adults, continued monitoring of legislated changes, and monitoring of the effects of the Affordable Care Act. Our council is proud of our efforts to assure shared innovation continues to benefit our community, and we certainly thank you for your support.
Thank you, Ms. Brinkmeyer. Supervisor Ray with a question.
I just wanted to take a moment to say thank you. It's my office that's the representative on this group, and one of the things that makes this so great is all the things that you've mentioned on the list of the to-do list, the goals, are very disparate. They're separate and they're distinct, and they're really specific needs that different populations in the same group need. And by having everybody come to the table once a month and really just sharing that information of how things are getting done, who is doing what, as you said, it streamlines services, it raises awareness, it increases the likelihood of referrals across agencies, and it just makes the whole system work. So thank you so much for the work that you do.
Thank you for recognizing that value. We enjoy it, too.
Hear, hear. A great can-do group. We thank you for being here. With that, Mr. Meacham on Thank a Veteran Month.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cummings, if you would come to the lectern. Thank you, sir. It's my honor to read this resolution proclaiming November 2014 as Thank a Veteran Month in San Luis Obispo County. Whereas the people of the County of San Luis Obispo have great admiration and the utmost gratitude for all the men and women who have selflessly served their country and this community in the armed forces in order to protect and preserve the freedoms enjoyed by our citizens and all Americans, and freedom is not free. Every veteran swears an oath to serve and will be willing to lay down his or her life for our freedoms. And whereas every veteran has paid a price by leaving their families and communities to place themselves in harm's way for the good of all, and the contributions and sacrifices of the more than 26,000 men and women living in San Luis Obispo County who served in the armed forces have been vital in maintaining the freedoms and way of life enjoyed by our citizens and others around the world. And whereas California Military and Veterans Code Sections 1365 designates the second full week of November as Veterans Appreciation Week, and during Thank a Veteran Month, all levels of government and private citizens come together to honor and recognize our veterans for the great sacrifice they have made defending freedom and pay deep respect for those who have made the ultimate sacrifice. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the County of San Luis Obispo Board of Supervisors does hereby proclaim November 2014 Thank a Veteran Month in San Luis Obispo County, urging all citizens and government leaders to honor the sacrifices made by our veterans and their families and pay homage to the men and women who have given their lives defending freedom and preserving our way of life.
You can't talk until you take the resolution.
No. Yeah. We had this packed house over at the country club with men and women who had served our country in World War II and their families. And got to say, it was one of the highlights of my entire life. It was just an extraordinary experience. And the good news is, because it was so sold out, I mean, getting everybody in and seated was a chore. The board happily did agree to pay to have AGP video it, and it will be made available on their site and for copies, so for anyone who missed it. But that was an extraordinary occasion, and Danis represented our vets and spoke, so that was really terrific.
Thanks, sir. I just wanted to say a couple quick words, and on that note, with the dinner for the World War II veterans, we lose roughly 1,000 to 1,500 World War II veterans a day right now. They're getting at that age where they're passing faster than ever, and so, doing those dinners like that and lunches and the honor flight and events like that is a great way to pay tribute to their sacrifice. I think their war, of all the recent wars that our country's been in, was it was all or nothing type of war. We wouldn't have the lives we have today if it wasn't for those men and women that sacrificed so greatly for us. And I think it's also fitting today that we're doing this on Election Day. I mean, I've got my absentee ballot here. I'm going to drop off after. I mean, we wouldn't have this right if it wasn't for these men and women and all the other veterans that have come behind them. You know, the veteran community is a community that is very mission-oriented, and they get the job done. And that's what all the veterans from World War II on have done, and the veterans that came previously. And so I want to thank all of them. I'd also like to thank Kevin Kennedy from Kennedy Club Fitness. He has donated free memberships for veterans this month as part of Thank a Veteran Month. And Greg from, where'd he go? Is he still here? There he is. From Vets Express. They do a phenomenal job of getting the veterans to their appointments for very, very low cost to the veterans. And I know all of you have helped support that program. And also George Moran from the Veterans Center. They do a great job in counseling our veterans that have been really through some of the toughest ordeals a vet can go through in fighting combat and military sexual trauma and stuff like that. So thank you all for all your support for the veterans. I really appreciate it. Lastly, on a lighter note, some people have been asking me why I'm sporting this ridiculous mustache this morning. It's Men's Health Month as well. And so it's Movember, so if you want to sport a mustache and look ridiculous, I encourage all of you.
Excuse me, Mr. Cummings.
That's just my beard, too.
Yes, sir, we have a request to speak. Mr. Kennedy and Greg Shearer to follow. Mr. Kennedy, you want to lead us off?
Yeah, hi. I'm Kevin Kennedy, the Chief Enlightenment Officer for Kennedy Club Fitness. And we have four clubs throughout the county, about 17,000 members and 300 employees. And we're selling the bracelets at each of the clubs and doing a special classes as fundraisers for the Thank a Vet, actually for the Ride On Vet Express that Greg, every month we try to do something, and we were so happy to find him for this program during Veterans Month. It's a great deal for us, and so we're just here to announce our support and that we're doing it, and come out and buy a bracelet at Kennedy Club Fitness.
Thank you, Mr. Kennedy. Mr. Shearer?
Hi, guys. thank you so much for talking to me about this Thank a Vet Month. And one of the things that I really want to stress more than anything is everybody, if you know somebody who served, take 2 minutes out on Veterans Day, call them up, and thank them for their service. I promise you it'll make their day, it'll make their month. And I want to thank all of you guys again for all your support for the Veterans Express. And I ask that, I know you guys are busy, but push it out in your community, okay, how important it is. And let them know about the wristbands being available at Kennedy Club Fitness and other little places in the community. And with that, I don't see anybody wearing a wristband.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Shearer.
Thank you, sir.
No, but I have my dog tags.
Blue one.
Yeah, you
did
yours on. I gave you one last year.
It's Mr. Shearer, who's the proponent of one of the remarkable can-do services in this county, gives us our wristbands. We thank him for that. We thank him and Mr. Cummings, Mr. Kennedy for promoting Thank a Veterans Month. I'd like to just add, absolutely thank a veteran, but particularly in focus to the veterans of World War II. If you have a minute, and you should, go one step further and ask them a little bit about their service. You will get a unique perspective. That generation, called the Greatest Generation for a reason, has a lot to tell us about notions of patriotism and service. And I encourage you to do that. It'll change your life. And I thank you for that. And we'll be moving on then to our next item, which is public comment for items not on the agenda. We'll go with the slips that are on the dais right now, which number some 7 or 8. And we'll ask speakers to speak to items that are not on the agenda and within the purview of the board. We'll start with Chuck Sasania, followed by Julie Tacker.
Good morning, board. My name is Chuck Sasania. I'm a resident of Los Osos. I've also been known as the Devil Incarnate and Cesspool Sasania, depending on which blog you read. I wanted to read to you from a letter from a citizens group out in Los Osos. Dear Cause and TAP supporters, we have a golden opportunity to engage in self-government through the formation of a community services district. If you ensure by your vote the implementation of the CSD, the solutions group plan, the community sewer plan, can become a reality. cause contribution to this plan has been technical support and...
Mr. Sasania, I'd ask you to bring it quickly to something within the purview of the board, please.
He is.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'll not ask for quiet in the audience. Mr. Sasania, something to do with the Board of Supervisors, please.
Since 1988, cause has instituted four lawsuits to prevent the county sewer plan from being imposed on the Los Osos community. Today, some 10 years later, one does not see any sewer lines being installed. Success for Los Osos. In the past, the Regional Water Board, on the eve of the assessment district election, threatened each Los Osos homeowner with a fine of $830,000 if the county sewer plan was not adopted. This threat was broadcast through the news media. This or other types of threats may be forthcoming, again, just prior to the November election. Watch for these items of misinformation. Nitrates from septic systems are polluting the bay. Drainage problems in Los Osos are caused by overflowing septic tanks. Look for the above types of distortions and lies to appear in the news media prior to the election. Then, before panic sets in, remember you have TAPS, CAUSE, and the Solutions Group here to support the people of Los Osos against such nonsense. The Solutions Group, now known to almost all Los Osos residents, formed last summer with scientists, engineers, marketing experts, lawyers working together in the common interest. They developed a viable alternate plan utilizing state-of-the-art, proven, and environmentally sound technology customized to Los Osos. This superior solution will cost less than half the county sewer plan. We all know who the marketing expert was, Pandora Nash Karner. She and the CSD that were formed took the county $54 million sewer plant, which was out of town, even though it was by the middle school, brought it into town, and jacked the cost up to $134 million. And then she has the nerve to write letters about me bankrupting the district because I didn't share her dream of a sewer plant in the middle of town. Manipulative hypocrisy. That's one thing you'll never see from me.
Ms. Tacker, followed by Dr. C. Hyde.
Good morning. I am Julie Tacker, and this morning I wanted to bring something to your attention. I'm not sure how your relationship works with County Council, but on November 29th, 2012, I requested 6 years of email between Supervisor Gibson and his assistant. And I did so. I was prompted by a newspaper article in which Ms. Neal suggested that she had read 6 years or 6,000 emails in the over the course of 3 days and exonerated Supervisor Gibson and Mrs. Sparrow from using any county resources in their six-year love affair. I got a response from Ms. Neal and was told that I would have those documents by the end of calendar 2012. She did ask my forgiveness and let me know that there'd be a delay and that I could expect them sometime later, and I received 2 years worth of those emails in February of 2013. Since February of 2013, Ms. Neal has provided 1 year's worth of email, leaving 3 years outstanding. I send her a note about once a month asking for the remainder of the request. And I just want to remind you that the California Public Record Act is a law, and you have to respond in a timely manner. Not only has she not been timely in her response, but a year ago, August, she put a presentation on for the board just for information on how public records were processed. And I was the only member of the public who participated that day, and I complained at the time that my request was taking a great deal of time. And she used that opportunity, and I actually don't believe she intended to embarrass me. I think the intention came from someone else, in showing the public how much time was put into the effort of providing the documents and how much staff time and how much that cost the county. And I just want to say that any cost associated with that request, and I am sorry that it's taking such a long time, but that cost should be borne by Supervisor Gibson.
Dr. Height, followed by Lindy Owens.
Dr. C. Height, Los Osos. And Dia de los Muertos is on the agenda, so I can't talk about it. But I can say this. The next time I come to this room to support a nonprofit, I better wear a costume to telegraph my position to you so that your disrespect for Los Osos, and apparently for me as an individual advocate, doesn't taint a worthy organization. By now you should know, and the county should know, that when I come to this room, I come to this room to appeal for equity, dignity, inclusion, not exclusion in your decisions. On October the 27th, you did receive a citizen's complaint. It went to every supervisor except for Supervisor Hill. I've not heard back from your administrator, so when you assure Supervisor Arnold that there is a process, that you listen to the public, and that these things are passed on, they need to be passed on and addressed. And the complaint is in two parts, because after all the years of my advocacy, in just a moment, Chairman Gibson, you undid all the work that I have done with this county. I am just 2.5 inches short of 6 foot tall. So when I stand here today and lean on my cane, you cannot talk down to me. When you berate a woman who is sitting on a mobility scooter in front of everyone, you have just told the entire community in which I live and support that that is the way you treat a senior citizen. That is the way you treat a woman. That is the way you treat an advocate for the poor. And that is the way you treat you berate disabled people. They need to be talked down to. They need to be put in their place. And you have undone all of the work that I have tried to accomplish with this board. When I leave this microphone, please do not add insult to injury by trying to justify your position. That excuse is no longer acceptable. She made me do it. I'm going to ask you to not reprimand the public. The board is here to hear the displeasure of the people. That is what you're paid for. We are not here to hear your displeasure. Thank you.
Ms. Owen, followed by Ben DeFada.
Good morning. Lindy Owen from Los Osos again. I'm going to start a slideshow. Last week, you approved, with no questions, the sign-off to the construction of the infrastructure for the sewer, the collection system in Los Osos. You said that ARB Construction, who is currently suing you for $20 million, and W.A. Razek had completed all the work that was in their contracts. And my concern has been for about 2 years that as they go through and leave their equipment parked and tear up entries into areas in near people's driveways, that it's not being tamped down, stomped down, and contained. It's a fluffed up dirt. Now in Los Osos, we walk in the streets because most of the lower parts of town do not have sidewalks. We park on the right of ways because of that's the tradition. But the areas that were done damaged have not been repaired. In some cases, they have. I think there's a couple. You can see a little bit of gravel that is put on the edge. But then there's the little edge, and then there's the sand that's running down. Luckily, the rain this last week was not strong enough to cause a huge amount, though there is a lot of dirt in the streets. The pamphlet that we got back in 2012 says the goal is to work in a continuous manner on every street and finish each area as we go. Well, this is not finished, and this was all damage done by the construction project. So I urge that you get this discussed, or let the county pay for it. If Mr. Gibson can use his discretionary funds, maybe we could get, you know, the project wrapped up. So now I'll go also to the Tri-W restoration area is another concern of mine. This is not only a restoration area that was damaged by the prior middle-of-town sewer, Tri-W site. It was also kind of turned into a drainage collection basin because it used to collect in its original natural state 340 acres of runoff from the hills up above. Well, it's been re-changed and everything. And last year, this was the final end of the rain. This was what was left. Now, this is supposed to be our park, or, you know, redone park, and it's also supposed to be a drainage collection. My complaint is that nothing has been done to prepare for this winter's rains, and much of the water appears to be diverted off to a neighboring private property that is definitely a washout at this point. The last rain showed that the water is being diverted, and we're not ready for the oncoming rain if we do get some. So please, Mr. Gibson, will you get on board? Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Owen. Mr. DeFatta, followed by Tom Meinhold.
Morning, Board. Ben DeFatta from Los Osos. I just want to tell some of you that were not here a few years ago. I was up at Cayugas Sunday, and they're using a skateboard park up there, which is not very large, and wood. And they get a lot of teenagers from vacationers. And here in California, in Los Osos, we had to build one, $725,000, I believe it was, made out of concrete, and hardly used, only by teenagers. It would have been better to build a pool for the, probably cheaper, and it could have been used by people of all ages. Anyway, what a waste of money. My mother would have had Sicilian cuss words for you guys that okayed that, those two projects who I'm going to tell you about the one now. The traffic calming in Santa Isabel, that was another $700,000 for six oval concrete medians to slow down the traffic, and all you got was to slow it down 3 miles. First, you put in the big rocks, and then somebody, I don't want to use the word, complained about that, and they wanted a landscaping with no water pipes. So citizens had to bring their hoses out there to water the landscaping. So it's just to tell you what we've been through, and a waste of money. So I hope that was in your purview, Mr. Gibson.
Thank you, Mr. DeFatta. Mr. Meinhold, followed by Mike Brown.
Good morning, supervisors. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak. I'm just going to hand out a little thank you to the everybody. I'm here to speak about 740 West Foothill, known as the Pike House. They had a big party Friday night, and I think everybody heard about it. A girl was sexually assaulted. I've talked to Cal Poly. I've talked to Cal Poly Police. I've talked to Sheriff's Department. And the number is they roughly had about 500 people there. They bust them in. It is not. It's the former This Old House restaurant, if you're not familiar with it and where I live. I'm not here to complain to you that you should have done something. I'm trying to offer a solution, and my solution is San Luis Obispo has adopted a noise ordinance program with very heavy, heavy fines. And what it has done is actually pushed the kids outside the city limits of San Luis. I'm actually 1 mile outside the city limits, so none of the noise ordinance fines apply to the property at 740 West Foothill. And talking to Keith Humphrey, who was VP of Student Affairs yesterday, I told him I was going to ask the board to look into maybe creating a buffer zone and you can use San Luis's fine structure as a roadmap to create this buffer, maybe from to the end of O'Connor out Los Osos to around the airport, because what the kids have done, and they know it, is that the fines don't apply out there. So what they do is they push them out. I commend them for busing the kids in and not drinking and driving, but they brought 500 kids to this old house restaurant. We were over in the Arbor trick-or-treating with the kids, came home, and we were like, oh, my goodness. I never seen anything quite that large before, and at my house anyway. And then we got home, and we were settling down. And I looked outside. My wife is sitting there talking to some young lady. And a few of you, I think, have been to my property and know that, you know, that she came. This young lady came into my property. I have gates. She was wandering around, and my wife kind of cornered her and wanted to know what was going on. And she was from the party, and she goes, it was so completely out of hand that she had to get out of there. And she was just looking for haven. Her friends had left. She couldn't. There was no shuttle bus to pick her up. So we walked her back over there, and that's when I walked her back over. The shuttle bus had arrived. Got her on the bus, and at that point, you know, San Luis PD, Cal Poly, and the Sheriff's Department all responded to the party. So I think it's time, because of what City of San Luis has done to protect themselves and their neighbors, it's time to protect the outlying areas. So, and I think this is just a great program, and it should work very well. I have family and friends who have rental property in San Luis, and they have been on the receiving end of this fine. And it's not pleasant for anybody because the landlord also is fined as well.
Mr. Meinhold, thank you. Since that is the second district, if you'd like to, if you could transmit this to our office, I'll take the paper copy and some details on that. We certainly will
absolutely
look into that and appreciate
it. And Cal Poly also wanted me to relay to you that they are very much in support of this idea.
Okay, very good. Thank you, sir. Mr. Brown, followed by Richard Margetson.
Mike Brown, representing CoLab. As the calendar year ends here, you have, I think, four meetings left after today before the new session begins in January, and you have organizational meetings and so forth. And we would hope you would think about a couple of reforms to agenda management to make it a little clearer for everybody as we approach that time. One would be that the long-range agenda, which shows tentatively what things are coming up in the ensuing meetings, be published on your agenda website. As you know, that site contains agendas for the board, planning commission, APCD, and so forth. And it seems like it'd be handy to have that so people could kind of plan and see what's coming rather than waiting till Tuesday or Wednesday before the week. And I realize they change, but it would be helpful. Secondly, many jurisdictions, in terms of public comment on consent calendar, treat each item as distinct and allow the full comment rather than compressing the entire consent calendar into one 3-minute comment, and we would hope you would change that. And again, our perennial request is that the staff, as it prepares agenda items, include the PowerPoint. Often you have many attachments to these items down there on the right, and it seems that it would be simple to add one to put the PowerPoint in. And so those are three things we would request as we approach the end here.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Mr. Margetson.
Richard Margetson. A little more than 9 years ago, there was an election in Los Osos to move the sewer. Unprecedented, three board members were recalled. New board was installed, and within hours, the opposition, the defeated board, and their supporters started an email stream with county officials. I'm going to read a couple of those emails. This basically goes to Shirley Bianchi, David Edge, Roger Briggs at the Water Board, Sorrel Marks at the Water Board. Gentlemen, and this is at 20 to 1 that evening after the election. Gentlemen, granted it's late, but could the Los Osos CSD transfer the sewer project to the county before the current CSD 3 leave office? Contracts have been signed. The project is underway. We are in violation of the Clean Water Act. Can an emergency agency be prepared to include transferring the project? Please, is there any way to salvage the project? Pandora Nash Carner. At 7:46 the next morning, David Edge responded, "Hi, Pandora. I understand your distress. However, the CSD remains the responsible local agency for the project. That means the district board could contract with the county or other willing agency, I guess, to do the project in the same manner that they contracted with a private company. However, assuming yesterday's results are certified, the new board could equally well vote to take back the project when seated. In other words, other agency options aren't realistically on the table unless the CSD goes out of existence and gives up its wastewater authority." David. At 8:45 that morning, from Pandora Nash Carner to David Edge. "Thanks, David. I hope the CSD gets fined out of existence fast enough to save the contractors and the low-interest loan." This is your second district, 20-year parks commissioner. After not getting her way in an election the previous evening, asking that the community get fined out of existence. And Mr. Meacham, last Tuesday I made a comment about the firemen, the issue about a fireman being flipped off in Los Osos by a member of the Community Service District Board. You're a member of the Fire Safe Council. I wondered if you had looked into that. I talked to a fireman yesterday. He's not real happy about it. And for your information, this same park commissioner, 20-year park commissioner, endorsed Mr. John Eric Storm for his re-election to the CSD board. That's what we get in Los Osos.
That was our last request to speak, and so I'll close it to public comment, and we will move on with the business of the day. Madam Clerk, would you introduce our next item, please?
Item number 34, submittal of a resolution commending Mid-American Solar for a $50,000 donation to repair the similar community building, and a request to create a new maintenance project in Fund Center 200 for similar community building repairs, and approve a budget adjustment to consolidate previously authorized funding into one project. District 5.
Ms. View, are you going to tell us a bit about this?
Yes, sir. So good morning, Mr. Chair, Board of Supervisors, Michelle View, General Services. Just a little bit about the similar community building. It is out in the Carissa Plains, and it was originally constructed in 1891 as a schoolhouse. Since 1955, it's been used as a community building, hosting several events for the community and the public. We recently had a historical resources evaluation, which stated that the similar building is historic in nature in that it contains a rare type of craftsman architecture that is significant for Slo County schoolhouses in this area. Over the decades, the facility has fallen into disrepair, requiring significant repairs to the foundation, electrical systems, plumbing, and many other systems throughout the facility. So previously, your board authorized $150,000 in maintenance funding for the repairs, and also authorized to have funding from the dissolution of CSA 17 to be added to the project. Mid-American Solar has also stepped up and has supported the similar community building through a $50,000 donation for the repairs of the facility. So today, staff is asking that the board create a new project so that the funding from these separate sources can be consolidated into one project. No additional funds are being requested, just a transfer of previously approved funding into one project. We would also ask that the board commend Mid-American Solar for the contribution to this project. And we received an email from Mr. Joel Twisman and the Carissa Plain Heritage Association, who thanks everyone for making the building renovation a reality. He asked to extend their thanks to Mid-American Solar for their donation and their exemplary involvement in the community. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. View. Supervisor Arnold, would you like to read the resolution before us?
And, I would.
And bring a representative of Mid-American Solar up,
yep,
if you're so inclined.
And before I read this resolution, I have to say this building actually is very sentimental to me. In 1978, I was a young wife, soon to be mother. My husband was working for the LaPanza Ranch, and we were living at the headquarters there on the edge of Carusa Plains. In 1978, people that lived out there had 8 party lines, meaning one telephone to be shared by 8 households. And our house had no telephone because the lines were full. You were on a waiting list if you even wanted a telephone in your house. So we lived out there, no telephone, no computers, very little TV reception. Our nearest neighbors, Bob and Alberta Lewis, were miles away. And that community building played a very important role in that farming community and had by then for some generations. Potlucks and card games and celebrations, baby showers, wedding showers. It's a wonderful building with a wonderful history, and I'm just really appreciative that the county and Mid-American are helping to restore that to be enjoyed by future generations in that area. So thank you very much. And I'll go ahead and read this resolution commending Mid-American Solar in recognition of their commitment to the community by supporting the project to repair the similar community building. Whereas the similar community building is a 3,270-square-foot facility constructed in 1891 as a schoolhouse and was moved to its current location at 10750 Carusa Highway and similar in 1910. And whereas the structure has been used since 1955 as a community building, serving as a public meeting place and has hosted a wide variety of public events, whereas a historical resources evaluation completed in January 2014 stated that the building is a good example of a rare architectural type for school buildings in San Luis Obispo County, and whereas the estimated cost of repairs is $300,000, whereas Mid-American Solar has supported the similar community through a $50,000 donation for the repairs of the similar community building, and whereas the contribution by Mid-American Solar will supplement funding designated by the county for the project to fund the repairs, therefore be it resolved and ordered by the Board of Supervisors that Mid-American Solar is hereby commended and thanked for service to the citizens of this county and in the commitment to repair and restore the similar community building. Thank you.
Ms. Kelly, would you like to come and receive that resolution?
Thank you.
I think we have a picture if you come back around.
Oh, two camera photo op. That's pretty good. Very good. Lectern his ears if you'd like, Ms. Kelly.
Good morning, Board and Chairman and Supervisors. Thank you for honoring us today, but it's really because of the hard work of the Carusa Plains Heritage Association and your General Services staff that we're even here today. As a local business and owner of Topaz Solar Farms, we're out there for the long haul. This community and this building is really important to us. We are very appreciative of the local community around Topaz and all the stakeholders in the Carusa Plains, and it is our hope, with a stable foundation, that the building will continue to be used and continue to be a heart and a part of the community out there. So we are just as a business owner and as a neighbor, we're really happy and honored to be able to support it and look forward to events in years to come. So thank you very much.
Very good. Thank you, Ms. Kelly, and thanks to Mid-America. I have no requests to speak on this item, so I'll close it to public comment, bring it back to the board, and offer Supervisor Arnold the motion.
I move to adopt this resolution.
Yes. And we have staff.
And the rest of the staff recommendation.
So the motion is staff's recommendation with a second from Ms. Ray. Mm-hmm. And no further discussion. We'll take a roll call vote.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes.
Ms. Ray?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
And Mr. Gibson?
Yes. Thank you very much. Thanks again. We'll look forward to that project's successful completion. With that, Madam Clerk, our next item, please.
Item number 35, report on the Economic Vitality Corporation regarding its progress implementing its economic strategic plan with financial support from the county and other sources, all districts.
Very good. Mr. Lilly, are you going to introduce here, or are we going straight to the EVC?
I would like to introduce, if I may.
You got it.
So in the interest of bringing a little additional visibility to the EVC and the activities that they implement, The staff and the EBC staff have reached a conclusion that it probably makes sense to appear before your board twice a year, once in the fall and then once in the spring, to describe what they're doing for the county's economy and under the contract with the county. And as soon as I can bring up the slideshow, then the EBC staff will make a presentation.
Vancheck, you can warm up your voice.
Thank you, sir. Good morning, members of the board. Mike Manchak here with the Economic Vitality Corporation. Well, I want to thank you all for your support. The county's been a great partner in working with the business community, and we're here to talk briefly about what we've been doing with your investment and the public's investment, and then also to recognize the people that have spent a lot of time volunteering for us, and we have some of those people here, and we'll bring them up to talk shortly. Before I do that, I would like to recognize someone who has been at the county for nearly 29 years. He was actually been vital to the economic strategy because he's been viewed as a friend by the business community. He has been a tremendous supporter of the business community, the economy, and the EVC. He actually goes back to even the starting of the EVC, which this year was 20 years ago. He is Dana Lilly. He's right in front of me. The EBC Board of Directors last month, they recognized him with a beautiful trophy to really recognize his support and to thank him and to genuinely appreciate his effort, and that he's really a model, I think, for the business community to work with. So thank you, Dana. Let me get right into our presentation. If I could just tee this up for you, please. This January is going on now 5 years. It's been very successful. We've gotten 2 statewide awards for it. It is something that it continues to morph. It continues to evolve. We continue to find opportunities and challenges and working directly with the business community to help solve those. We have these cluster initiatives for which Christine Rogers, the program manager of the EBC, and also Chris Vardis, who's a board member, is also here. We have also some co-chairs. We've got Russ Levenway of Techtegrity. We've got Lenny Grant and Vic Montgomery, both of RRM Design. And they are just 3 of 6 cluster co-chairs of 6 clusters that are here just to talk about examples of what's important and what's being worked on. We do talk about, briefly in ending here, we talk about Economic Strategy 2.0. What this really means is that we've evolved. In the first days when Adam Hill and Frank Meacham were at every one of our meetings, meeting with the business community, we've evolved from that. We've really learned. We've implemented. We've gotten lessons learned, and we've moved on. But we also have, which I think is exciting, we have a growing list of partners and a growing list of supporters that continue to spend time with us on this. So with that, I'm going to introduce Christine Rogers, Program Manager, who will talk just briefly about the next steps in this update.
Very good. Morning, Ms. Rogers.
Good morning. Thank you very much, Chair Gibson. Board of Supervisors. We are going to talk here. We're primarily focusing on the first quarter of this fiscal year, but wanted to touch on the past accomplishments since it's been some time since we presented to this board. Specifically, in the interest of time, Dana, could we go to the next slide? Thank you. We're going to talk specifically just about those initiatives that tie to our current activities. And just to point out that the initials that you see after those titles represent which clusters are participating on those initiatives. Beginning with the 805 Connect project, that really is just that. It's a resource to connect our businesses and our consumers with the expertise, the products and services, and the things that they need here in our county. We have long known that we are losing sales revenue, that our businesses are purchasing products and services from outside of the region, not because we don't have them here, but because there's a lack of awareness of what we do have here and how to find those resources. So we reached out to our neighboring counties, Ventura County and Santa Barbara County, to develop this online business resource. The solution is really to keep those dollars here, at least within our Central Coast region. We hope that this resource is going to promote business-to-business transactions as well as enhance the potential for collaboration. We have that product was launched in April of this year and currently has over 1,000 businesses registered. In continuing to talk about Tri-County partnerships, we have to first,
look at the amazing resources that we have in our county that have begun to build our capacity and enhance the awareness of how important broadband infrastructure is to our community. In a market that is increasingly more global with e-commerce and the internet opening up knowledge exchanges, it's critical for our businesses to remain competitive, for our educational institutions in, you know, breaching those shortfalls in funding and going to distance learning, our healthcare facilities to increase our quality of care, and to our communities. We reached out again to our neighboring counties, and through a CPUC grant, the Broadband Consortium was formed. Its goal is really to assess and understand our capacities and our deficiencies and to begin to build upon those platforms. In just a little while, Russ Levenway is going to get up and share with you our progress on that project. We have had a lot of discussions at this podium about workforce housing. That project has been a long-term project, and we anticipate that it's going to continue to be a long-term project. It's critical to our businesses. We know that they're challenged in attracting and retaining the skilled talent that they need because of that difference between our median incomes and our median home prices. So this project really is about making sure that we have the range of housing types that we need in a range of affordability that works and supplies the needs of our employees. And Lenny Grant is going to join us in just a few minutes and share about the progress in that project. Along those lines, you know, infrastructure, we have learned so much through the Infrastructure Committee in working with county staff, mostly that this is a very long-term process. And part of the reason that it's a long-term process is because of that shortfall in funding and how challenging it is to piece that funding together to be able to achieve those projects. The Infrastructure Committee came together at the request of the Building Design and Construction Cluster, and it really, it's about marrying that advanced knowledge about development projects and financing that's coming forward on the private side with those long-term resources that the county has put together so that we can come up with that balance and that mix of funding to make these projects a reality and promote that potential for public-private partnership. That's, we have Vic Montgomery here with us today, and he's going to share about that project. I did want to touch just briefly on our work with the California Stewardship Network. We know that action at the state level has significant impact on our regional economy, and the EVC supports that effort through the hosting of regional forums so that we can gain a better understanding of what our industry priorities are, to then become a feedback loop to the state through a statewide economic summit, and then participating on those region-wide action teams. Some of the outcomes of those action teams were the recent state legislature for the enhanced infrastructure districts, looking for more long-term or sustainable funding sources for workforce housing, things that we know ultimately can have a beneficial impact on our local economy. So we continue to support those efforts. Again, you know, we have so many accomplishments here. In the interest of time, so that the cluster members can share, we're not going to cover all of them. So as we move forward to the economic initiatives, I did want to touch briefly on the economic analysis program. This was the outcome of the one-year pilot project that we partnered with county staff. The goal of that project was really just to demonstrate how beneficial economic information could be in the public review process for discretionary permit projects so that we could begin to have a better understanding of how it impacts our local economy through job creation, increased earnings, and sales revenues. That project was successful in that this board directed staff to continue on and to begin incorporating that information into our public review process. We've continued to work with the amazing Dana Lilly, who we have tried, practically pleaded him to defer his retirement, but he is not cooperating with us. But as a result of that, we have made significant progress on the RFQ process. We're working with some economic firms that we think might be able to bring those resources to our community. And in addition to that, we have initiated a pilot project with the city of Pismo Beach. And the goal of that is just to demonstrate how these programs could be a benefit to our local municipalities. It's looking at some land use in their downtown area and what the economic impacts of that might be. So we hope to be able to bring that progress forward to you in the near future. And with that, I would love to bring up Vic Montgomery, who is with RM Design. He has been a champion for the Infrastructure Committee, and I'm pleased to have him share our progress there.
Very good. Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Montgomery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. I can't remember the last time I was here, but I remember what I said. Talked a little bit about educating ourselves as to how the county's infrastructure process works for prioritizing projects. And I told you we were trying to educate ourselves so we could be reasonable partners in that process. So we've spent, from I guess last winter until now, educating ourselves. We think we know enough about how it happens to be useful in the process. And so this fall we're going to be participating along with Public Works and some other folks in reviewing those projects. We've set up an internal criteria on our committee to review projects and try and determine what we think would be worthy if we were going to propose a project that might not be on the county's list already. And probably something more important is we took a hint from the county administrator from 2 years ago, I think, about participating outside of the normal process of the EVC and the county in doing community outreach for infrastructure projects to try and help energize your partners, the CSDs and CSAs, to get them to coordinate and look at infrastructure as a bigger picture process than simply what's going on in their district. And we've made some progress toward having an internal program for outreach to support the infrastructure projects that the county is working on. So with that, I'm done. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Montgomery. Who's up next?
I'd like to invite Russ Levenway, who's going to share a bit about the Broadband Consortium.
All right. Morning, Mr. Levenway.
Hello. Members of the board, Mr. Chairman, you know, everything is really coming together in terms of the state funding for a broadband grant, in terms of the fact that we have great support from the county here for economic development, and the understanding that bandwidth is, in general, is a great equalizer. It's critical for economic development. And if we can bring a 98% adoption rate here, we can meet statewide goals and statewide mandates for broadband adoption. So we've been working methodically toward the goal that the grant outlined. And the ultimate goal is to have a strategy for how we would implement broadband in this region to achieve that kind of 98% adoption rate. It sounds very ambitious. But just recently, we had a very important stakeholders meeting. At that meeting, the meeting was set up in such a way that we had a very broad representation among members of the community, from city and county leaders, business members, and residents of the community. The whole idea was to have three focus groups, and those groups were around strategic deployment of broadband. That means what regions or areas do we have to prioritize to have maximum impact, and also what is the order of deployment. And then the second group was around policy. What do we have to do in terms of working with the county, working with the cities and community services districts here in order to have a robust broadband network built out and coordinated smoothly? In point of fact, having the county be so supportive of this initiative is really key. And having successful projects like we have already had with the city of San Luis Obispo and the city of Grover Beach in how you line up broadband infrastructure, those are great models for us to build and work on. And the last group was on accelerated adoption. If construction is already happening, can we piggyback on that and lay fiber cabling? What awareness do we have to build so that if we provide 98% broadband availability to this community, will people sign up for it and use it and utilize it? So those are the key questions that we had. We had great constructive feedback and takeaways. Now, in moving forward, the consortium has made great progress on creating what's called a GIS map of existing broadband connectivity. We're also working on surveys so we can really get an accurate representation of where bandwidth is lacking and where it would be utilized if it was available. So we are continuing to move forward, and we are really excited about the prospect that this would bring for this community. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you, Mr. Levenway.
Okay, with that, Lenny Grant was going to be joining us, but does not appear to have made it. So I just want to give you a brief update on the workforce housing project, because that is so critical. We have had some very productive meetings with staff in scoping that project, the workforce ordinance, and design guidelines, and it's very encouraging. We look forward to continue on that project. In addition to that, on the private industry side, we continue to work in preparing for a subsequent economic summit to begin to look at opportunities between employers and the development industry. So those projects are moving forward, and it's very encouraging. And with that, I would like to bring up Chris Vardis. Another strategic and an important component of the economic strategy is advocacy and really moving forward the progress and the initiatives that are important. And Chris Vardis has done some amazing work on our EDC advocacy policies that he's going to share with you.
Very good. Mr. Vardis.
Morning, board members. I don't know if amazing is the right word, but hopefully interesting. Moving on to the next slide. So the Economic Vitality Corporation really strives to promote change that will lead to further economic vitality for the county while maintaining awareness and respect for the existing policies that the county has in place to protect our quality of life. But the advocacy policy that the EVC developed some years ago was actually adopted prior to the development and implementation of the economic strategy. And so we worked with the members of the six clusters of the economic strategy to refine those policies with respect to three things. One is to make them consistent with the different initiatives that those clusters are working on. Two, to recognize that the EVC really has increased its awareness and position within the county, developed a lot of partnerships, and as a result, there's a lot of requests for the EVC to take a position on a specific issue or project. And thirdly, to update these policies, recognizing that the county a few years ago identified or designated the EVC as a referral body as part of its policy making a refinement process. So any land use policy or other policy that is germane to the mission of the EVC would be referred to the EVC early in the process so that the county can solicit feedback from the EVC and use that as the process to refine its policy that it's either amending or adopting or creating. But with that, key thing that the EVC recognizes that it's a 501c3 and that it does not advocate for specific projects. It gets requests all the time to advocate for specific projects, and it's really a careful balancing act that the EVC maintains to make sure that it doesn't violate its position as a 501c3 and provide preferential treatment to one party at the expense of another party. Moving on. The EVC has advocated for a number of things to promote and enhance the implementation of the economic strategy and to assist the clusters in their efforts to achieve or implement the initiatives that they're working on. These include working with the county to retain and enhance the business activity and air flight volume of the airport, to working with broadband, to working with different cities on their housing elements or with the county and the update of their economic element. A lot of different things have been advocated for over the past number of years. The EVC continues to set a number of key policy priorities within its board of directors. These include maintaining support of the implementation of the economic strategy and providing the necessary resources to the six clusters, recognizing that those clusters are subject matter experts for things germane to their industry. So where possible, we try to leverage that resource and provide, a good communication to different entities based on things that are germane to both the EVC as well to the different clusters. Christine talked about the number of initiatives that we're working on, and we've tried to make sure that all of our policy priorities are consistent with those initiatives. Moving on. Thank you. These include, of course, retaining the airport service, working with the county on workforce housing and infrastructure. Workforce housing keeps being mentioned, but that is one of the key initiatives that both the BDC cluster is working on, as well as other clusters recognize that that's critical for them to expand and enhance their businesses. Their ability to retain talent and recruit new talent is directly related to the availability of workforce housing so that their employees can afford to buy a home and live here. The Uniquely Slow had a number of priorities or advocacy policies already established. A key change that we made with this was the last bullet, where we changed it to advocate for strategic and unified public-private partnerships. And this is really to strive consistency with the Visit Slow initiative. Mike Manchek and the EBC has really worked hard with Stacey Jacob and the staff at Visit SLO to create a successful initiative with that to try to establish a countywide VID. And I know the city of Pismo Beach had recently endorsed that program, and personally I think it's great. Moving on. Knowledge and innovation, that cluster recognizes the importance of our colleges and universities as well as the students that go to school there. And so the cluster has really worked to provide advocacy or support for new programs that those universities or colleges are establishing, as well as to recognize that the infrastructure facilities that those schools maintain or are proposing to construct are critical toward providing the necessary workforce for their industry. So with that, the EBC has advocated with Cal Poly and worked with them to provide good messaging and communication about the student housing project there at the site. Building design and construction cluster. A lot of time was spent to really align the policies to be consistent with the different initiatives that the cluster is working on. If you look at all six of the clusters, the BDC construction cluster is probably the most engaged, most involved, and has the most difficult things to work on and the highest number with really workforce housing, infrastructure, and then lastly looking at ways to enhance or expand opportunities for commercial and industrial facilities and try to co-locate those in areas where it makes sense. So a lot of effort's been put into that. Health services, that cluster, key thing that they're working on is try to increase the reimbursement rate for Medi-Cal and Medicaid. If you look at it, at all 58 counties, San Luis Obispo County has some of the lowest reimbursement rates in the state. I don't know why, but that cluster is one of the key things is working at a state level to try to change that, make it more fair, recognizing that although wages can be lower than other areas, their cost of living can be quite high. Nursing is a key thing, and working with Cuesta College to enhance their nursing program. And lastly, you know, this idea of a health information network. I know some of the key health institutions within the county, including Dignity and Tenet, have been working to modernize their information program. And with that and progress at a national level, the cluster is monitoring that and seeing how there could be a point where they could work to establish an information network within the county. Green energy is kind of more from solar, strictly solar, large-scale solar to rooftop solar, as well as energy conservation, recognizing energy conservation is a key thing to enhance the county's energy portfolio. So if you reduce energy demand and consumption, everyone benefits from that. So the green energy cluster is working on a number of energy conservation programs and is actually working to reunite the different members of that industry, get them all together to talk about what are the additional opportunities for that cluster and how can we further refine our policies to advocate for change and progress that creates a better energy portfolio and opportunities within the county. Specialized manufacturing is a bit unique. Those businesses really don't compete with each other that much in the county. Most of their customers are out of town, out of county, out of state. But by getting together and talking about business opportunities and the way they can enhance each other's business processes, they all will capitalize from that. And so the idea of working together to advocate for an information exchange so they can share knowledge and information is critical for that in that sector. One of the things that we're working on as we progress with implementation is about clarity and focus. When the strategy was adopted, there was a large number of initiatives that were identified for implementation. But over time, you know, there's some of those have been achieved, but there's been a more of a focus on really what are the best opportunities and what are the things that are going to generate the greatest results and how can we focus our energy together to achieve success. And that's really what those clusters are doing with the EBC is providing clarity and focus on each other's actions. And as part of that, the cluster chairs of each industry sector cluster are getting together to talk and at least a quarterly basis to monitor the progress of the economic strategy implementation and how can they work and support each other in their efforts both to, you know, tactical day-to-day efforts to implement the initiatives, as well as how can they better advocate for change. A lot of times the level of advocacy is reacting to a project that is going before a body for votes, such as yourselves, and how can we write letters to support and encourage a yes vote if necessary. But the idea is, how can we step back and 5 months before that project goes to vote, how can we develop more effective messaging and communication? How can we further address issues and solve things so that when projects are presented before County Board of Supervisors or a city, there's already more teamwork and there's already a more informed populace, and hopefully that will encourage or result in more change. So things we're working on. When the strategy was developed, the vision for that strategy was, this is where the county is now, and how can we increase the number of head of household jobs and enhance the level of business volume or activity? And what are the key industry sectors that have the greatest opportunity for growth, and what would it take to enhance their business volume? That was the vision. But what the cluster chairs are getting together to do now is try to qualitatively describe what they see as the vision from an economic development perspective for the county 5 years from now, 10 years from now, and over time try to put some parameters or some quantitative metrics behind that vision and monitor through a dashboard the efforts to in which they're actually meeting that vision. So we're working as part of development of an economic strategy 2.0, if you will, to really encapsulate what are the focus initiatives that we're working on, what policies are we advocating for to help lend the successful implementation of those initiatives, and what is the vision on behalf of the business committee of where they would like to see the county go, and what is the success rate in which it's happening. And the idea is to bring that to you next spring as an economic strategy 2.0 or 2.1, 3.0, and to present that to you for your review and consideration. So kind of moving forward, we see that as the next step, and we think it's a good step, and we're looking forward to that presentation. Last slide is about partnerships, recognizing that the EBC can't do this alone, nor can all the hard work of the cluster participants do it alone. They really need the support and partnership from the county. And certainly the EBC and the cluster members are very appreciative of the county's support in this endeavor. And there's a lot of other entities that the EBC works with to ensure success. But speaking of partnership, one of the key persons who's led that charge with partnerships is Mr. Dana Lilly. And I'm personally going to miss him. It's been great working with him, and I wish him the best in his retirement. So with that concludes our presentation, and we're all here to answer any questions that you may have.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Vardis, and other members of the EDC. Appreciate your work on a wide range of interesting ideas and initiatives. Are there any questions from my colleagues? Seeing none, I will open it to the public, though I have no request to speak, so I'll close it to the public, bring it back to the board. This was a presentation item, not an action item, so we will thank you. Look forward to seeing you in the spring and wish you well on your many discussions. Thanks so much for being here today. With that, Madam Clerk, if you would introduce our next item, please.
Item number 36, a hearing to consider a resolution to increase membership on the Shandon Public Cemetery District Board, District 1.
Mr. Meacham, is this?
This is me.
This is you.
Or Ms. Neal.
I'm sorry, County Council.
That's all right.
Yeah, let's not let him charge off on his own. Thank you, Ms. Neal. I appreciate that.
Mr. Meacham, if you'd like to present this item, I'm perfectly happy to defer to you.
No, not at all.
But she's
please.
Listening. She's listening very carefully.
Rita Neal, County Council. This item initially did come through Supervisor Meacham's office, but our office does provide advice to the cemetery districts within this county, and there are several, and at the moment I can't remember how many there are, but they are allowed pursuant to the Health and Safety Code. Your board makes appointments to those cemetery districts, and they really provide a good service to each of the communities that do have small cemeteries. I've been out to several of them myself and talked to board members, and they really take pride in taking care of the cemeteries. So Shandon came to us and requested that this board approve their request to increase the size of their board. It's often difficult to find residents to serve on these district boards, and in this case, Shandon currently has three members, is asking for an increase to five members. That will really help with their ability to run their meetings, have quorums, and have some continuity in services. People come on and off the board. So your action today would be approving their request to increase their board from three to five.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
Good. Well, that you have, well, let's open it to the public. I do have a request to speak from Mr. Doug Alley.
Good morning. I'm here simply as a member of the Shandon District Board to request your support in this resolution and also perhaps to answer any questions if you have any.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Alley, I don't see questions coming from the dais. We appreciate you coming in to address us today. And if you have no further comments, I'll go ahead and close public comment, bring it back to Supervisor Meacham.
Thank you. And I did bring this forward on request of the Cemetery Board, and with that I would move adoption of the resolution increasing the membership of the Shandon Public Cemetery Board from three to five members.
Thank you, Mr. Meacham, and thank you, Ms. Ray. This doesn't appear to be a controversial issue, so I will ask Madam Clerk for a roll call vote, please.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Ms. Ray?
Yes.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Alley. Appreciate it. Our next item, 37, is a series of Ag Preserve actions. We are going to take them individually, as I expect we are, since that's been our tradition. I do have Ms. Kirk with a request to speak, indicates for questions only, so if you hear something and want to pop up, we can do that. Otherwise, we will have Mr. Waller get settled, and we will get on a roll.
Would you like me to introduce the item?
Oh, well, yes. Thank you, Miss. I was getting so efficient I could, you know, see us getting out of here before lunch. But, yes, let's go ahead and introduce the item and a quick staff introduction from Ms. Carroll.
Item number 37, hearings to consider seven proposals to establish agricultural preserves, districts 1, 3, and 5.
All right. Ms. Carroll, my apologies.
That's okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'll try and get you out, too. We do have seven applications today to establish agricultural preserves. When you add up the total number of acres, it's about 1,800 plus acres to add to our Ag Preserve program. And Terry Waller is our project manager and our program manager for this program, and he's going to be making the presentation today. We do have seven preserves, so we will have the board act on all seven of those individually. Thank you.
All right. Now, Mr. Waller.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the board, Terry Waller, planning staff. The first item is a request by Niels Utzon to establish an agricultural preserve, which will later enable the applicant to enter into a land conservation contract. The 164-acre parcel is located within the agriculture land use category at 3090 Ranchita Canyon Road on the northern side of Ranchita Canyon, at the intersection of Ranchita Canyon Road and Von Dolan Road. This is approximately 3.5 miles east of San Miguel. It's in the North County Alpamar, Australia planning area, and its file number AGP 2013-00006. The agricultural use of the property is approximately 161 acres planted in irrigated vineyard. The vineyards were planted in 2012 and 2013, fairly recent plantings. The property's 164 gross acres exceeds the minimum 40 acres required to qualify as a prime land agricultural preserve. I would note that all of the plantings are on Class 4 soils. The appropriate minimum parcel size for the agricultural preserve is 40 acres based on the irrigated vineyard, and the appropriate term is 20 years because the site's located more than a mile from the San Miguel Urban Reserve Line. The recommendations on this from the Agricultural Preserve Review Committee and the Planning Commission are for approval to establish this agricultural preserve. I would be happy to respond to any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Waller. Any questions for Mr. Waller? Seeing none, I will open it to the public, but I have no request to speak, so I'll close it to the public, bring it back to the board. Mr. Meacham.
Move approval.
Thank you, Mr. Meacham.
Second.
Thank you, Ms. Ray. And I expect we need a roll call vote on that.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Ms. Ray?
Yes.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes.
And Mr. Gibson?
Yes. Item B.
The next item is AGP 2013-00007. It's also a proposal by Neil Zudsen to establish an agricultural preserve to enable the applicant to enter into a land conservation contract. This property consists of 185 acres. It's located within the agriculture land use category at 675 North Bethel Road on the western side and approximately 2,000 feet south of the intersection of North Bethel and Highway 46, adjacent to the Templeton Urban Reserve line. The site is in the North County Salinas planning area. The agricultural use of the property is a total of approximately 88 acres planted in irrigated vineyard. And this property is eligible based on the 88 acres. It exceeds the 40 acres necessary to qualify for a prime land agricultural preserve. The plantings are on class 2 and 4 irrigated soils. The appropriate minimum parcel size for the agricultural preserve is 40 acres based on the irrigated vineyard. The appropriate term in this case is 10 years because the site is located within 1 mile of the Templeton Urban Reserve line, actually right next to it. And the recommendation from the Agricultural Preserve Review Committee and the Planning Commission are for establishment of the agricultural preserve.
Thank you, Mr. Waller. With no questions, I will open it to the public. With no request to speak or anyone coming forward, I'll close it to the public, bring it back to the board. Mr. Meacham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move approval.
Thank you, Mr. Meacham.
Second.
Thank you, Mr. Hill. And a roll call vote.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Ms. Ray?
Yes.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes. Item C.
The next item is a proposal by Douglas Ares. It's AGP 2013-00004. It is also a request to establish an agricultural preserve, which will later enable the applicant to enter into a land conservation contract. The 40.5-acre parcel is located within the agriculture land use category at 1205 Willow Creek Road, and this is next to the intersection of Willow Creek and Peachy Canyon Road and Loose Horse Road, approximately 4 miles northwest of the intersection of Vineyard Drive and Highway 46. And approximately 5.5 miles northeast of the urban reserve line of Templeton. It is in the North County Adelaide planning area. The use of the property consists of about 20.5 acres planted in irrigated vineyard and orchards. The property's 40.5 gross acres exceeds the minimum 40 acres necessary to qualify for prime land preserve. The appropriate minimum parcel size is 40 acres based on irrigated vineyard and orchard, and the agricultural use is on class 3, 4, and 7 soils. The term that appropriate for this property is 20 years because the site's located more than 1 mile from Templeton Urban Reserve line, and the recommendations for the Agricultural Preserve Review Committee and Planning Commission are for approval of this request to establish an agricultural preserve.
Thank you, Mr. Waller. With no questions, I'll open it to the public. With no one coming forward, I'll close it to the public, bring it back to the board, and Mr. Meacham.
Move approval.
Thank you.
Second.
Thank you, Mr. Hill. And a roll call.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Ms. Ray?
Yes.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes.
And Mr. Gibson?
Yes. Item D.
The next item is AGP 2013-00012. And it's a proposal by Paper Street Vineyard to establish an agricultural preserve, which will later enable the applicant to enter into a land conservation contract. The property consists of 321 acres. It's located within the agriculture land use category at the terminus of Kyler Canyon Road. It's approximately 2 miles northwest of the intersection of Kyler Canyon Road and Arbor Road Drive, and approximately 2.5 miles northwest of the intersection of Arbor Road and Highway 46. And approximately 3 miles northwest of the urban reserve line of Paso Robles. The site is in the North County Adelaide planning area. The use of the property is a total of approximately 106 acres planted in irrigated vineyards. The applicant's 106 acres exceeds the minimum 40 acres necessary to qualify for a prime land preserve. However, in this case, there's other uses on the property. There's also grazing land use, and it's a fairly substantial property size. It's 321 acres. So we applied the mixed use calculation and feel that the appropriate minimum parcel size for this particular property is 160 acres based on the mixed uses. The appropriate term is 20 years because the site's located more than 1 mile from Paso Robles Urban Reserve line. And the recommendations from Agricultural Preserve Review Committee and the Planning Commission is for approval of this request to establish an agricultural preserve.
Thank you, Mr. Waller. I will open it to the public. With no one coming forward, I'll close it to the public, bring it back to the board, and Mr. Meacham.
Move approval.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Ray. And a roll call.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Ms. Ray?
Yes.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes. Item E.
Item E is file number AGP 2014-00002, and it's a proposal by Labella Grande LLC to establish an agricultural preserve, which will later enable the applicant to enter into a land conservation contract like the other properties. This property consists of quite a bit of acreage, 1,074 acres. It's located within the agricultural land use category at 6186 West Pozo Road on the southeastern side of West Pozo Road at its intersection with Highway 58. It's 1 mile east of Santa Margarita, and the site is in the North County Salinas River sub-area planning area. The use of the property is, the majority of it, is used for cattle grazing. The applicant's acreage far exceeds the minimum 320 acres necessary to qualify as a rangeland agricultural preserve under the new rules for larger rangeland preserves. It also has approximately 922 acres of class 4, 6, and 7 soils that are listed as moderately to well-suited as rangeland in the Natural Resource Conservation Service ratings of the property. And the appropriate minimum parcel size is 320 acres based on the rangeland agricultural use. And the appropriate term in this case is 10 years because the site is partially located within 1 mile of the Santa Margarita Urban Reserve line. And this is as specified directly in the rules of procedure. The recommendation from the Agricultural Preserve Review Committee and the Planning Commission on this property is for approval of the request to establish an agricultural preserve. And I just like to note that this is a substantial addition to the program because of the acreage involved.
Quite so. Thank you, Mr. Waller. I will open it to the public. With no one coming forward, I'll close it to the public, bring it back to the board. Ms. Arnold.
Yep. Terry, this piece, this 1,000 acres, 1,074 acres, was formerly part of the Santa Margarita Ranch, what was considered. Yeah, just a confirmation on that.
That's my understanding also.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. And Ms. Arnold, a motion?
Yes, I'll make a motion to approve.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Meacham. And a roll call vote.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Ms. Ray?
Yes.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes. Item F.
The next item is AGP 2013-00013. It's a proposal by Earl J. Darway Family Trust to establish an agricultural preserve to enable the applicant to enter into a land conservation contract. The subject parcel will result from a lot line adjustment, which is in process actually right now, and will need to be completed prior to the execution of the contract later this year or at the beginning of next year, depending on how quickly that occurs. And the property consists of 25 acres. It's located within the agricultural land use category at 215 Greengate Road, approximately 400 feet northeast of the intersection of Carpenter Canyon Road, also known as Highway 227, and Price Canyon Road, and 2.5 miles southeast of the city of San Luis Obispo. The site is in the South County Planning Area, San Luis Obispo sub-area south. And the use of this property is 24 of the 25 acres are in irrigated row crops, and it is eligible under a special section that was put in to the rules of procedure in recent years called the High Productivity Prime Land Small Specialized Farm provision, and it allows for slightly smaller properties to establish 20-acre agricultural preserves if 10 of the 20 acres is fully planted in irrigated crops and is on class 1 or 2 soils. So these are highly productive, smaller farms, and we haven't had too many of these, but this is a good example of one of those. And it also has a requirement for annual gross value to exceed $2,000 or more per acre for 3 of the previous years. The agent and the applicant provided information on the crop history and the value of these crops, and they exceeded this substantially in terms of the productivity on each acre. The 25-acre site is 25 acres of the 25-acre site is planted in 24 acres of irrigated row crops, and 21.25 acres are on class 1 soil, and 2.75 acres are on class 3 and 4 soils. Based on the class 1 soils, the applicant easily qualifies for this high productivity prime land agricultural preserve. The appropriate minimum parcel size for the preserve is 20 acres based on the irrigated row crops and the soils class. And the term, appropriate term, is 20 years since the site's located over 1 mile from the urban reserve line of San Luis Obispo. The recommendations from the Agricultural Preserve Review Committee and Planning Commission are for approval.
Very good. I will open it to the public with no request to speak. I'll bring it back to the public, bring it back to the board. Mr. Hill.
Yes, move approval of staff recommendation.
Thank you.
Second.
Thank you, Mr. Meacham. And a roll call, please.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Ms. Ray?
Yes.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes. Item G.
The final application today is AGP 2013-00014. It's a proposal by Earl J. Darway Family Trust also. And it is also a request to establish an agricultural preserve, which will later enable the applicant to enter into a land conservation contract. It is also part of a lot line adjustment in process, as discussed earlier. This property consists of 46 acres located within the agriculture land use category at 215 Greengate Road. And it's basically the adjoining property. So it's off Carpenter Canyon Road. And the site is in the South County planning area, San Luis Obispo subarea south. The agricultural use of this property is 40.5 acres in irrigated row crops. The site itself, the resulting parcel, will be 46 acres, so most of the property will be in the irrigated row crop use. It's eligible based on the 40.5 acres on class 1 and 3 soils in this case, and it qualifies for a prime land preserve because it exceeds the minimum of 40 acre required for that type of preserve. And the minimum parcel size that's appropriate for this property is 40 acres based on the irrigated row crops in this case. And the appropriate term is also 20 years as the adjoining property was for minimum parcel size. The recommendation from Agricultural Preserve Review Committee and the Planning Commission is also for approval of this request to establish the agricultural preserve. And that concludes my presentation.
Very good. Thank you. I will open it to the public. With no one coming forward, I'll close it to the public, bring it back to the board. Mr. Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move approval of staff recommendation.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Ray. And one more roll call vote.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Ms. Ray?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes.
And Mr. Gibson?
Yes, thank you. And Mr. Wall, before you go, just out of curiosity, we've made some very nice additions to the Ag Preserve program. Do you have off the top of your head the basic stats on that in terms of the percentage of ag land and the percentage of the county? I mean, we have an exceptional participation rate, even with the state having cut subventions.
That's true. And many of our agriculturalists really appreciate the program, and it's really super helpful to them in staying in business and moving forward with the agricultural use of their property, and helps the agricultural economy overall. In this case, the number that I always use as a general average number is rather rounded number is 800,000 acres, but it's actually somewhat less, more like 780,000 acres of land that's in the program. And of course, we update that every year because some of the properties come out in non-renewal and more are added. In this case, we have some substantial additions, so it's really good.
Very good. Yep. Thank you very much for your work on that. That concludes this item.
was my understanding from the Office of Counsel that we do not have closed session today, so we don't have comment. And with that, we are in recess until 1:30. Thank you, Madam Clerk. We will convene the afternoon session. We did not meet in closed session today, so the normal non-report will not occur. With that, then, Madam Clerk, if you would introduce our afternoon item.
Item number 39, a hearing to consider an appeal by Avila Valley Advisory Council, the Subdivision Review Board's approval of a tentative parcel map CO14-0021, development plan, coastal development permit SUB2013-0054, and adoption of the proposed mitigated negative declaration pursuant to the California Environmental Quality Act to allow subdivision of a 6,000-square-foot parcel into two 3,000-square-foot planned development parcels and construction of two single-family units for vacation rentals located on Colony Lane in the community of Avila Beach, District 3.
Very good. Thank you. Before I turn it over to Mr. Bergman, let me just outline the format today. Since this is an appeal of a land use decision, we'll go with a standard format. We're going to start with a presentation by staff. We'll then go to a 10-minute segment for the appellant or appellants to present information they think relevant. We'll follow that with a 10-minute a presentation by the applicants. We'll then open it to general public comment at 3 minutes apiece for anyone who's not spoken within those two blocks. We'll come back with 5 minutes of wrap-up for the applicant, followed by 5 minutes for the appellant, and we'll go then to deliberations on the board. With that, Mr. Bergman.
Great. Thank you, Chair Gibson, board members. Today for this hearing you have Megan Martin, who's the project manager, and it looks like you got Mr. Robeson, Mr. Waller, Ms. Griffin, and myself at the standby to answer any questions. With that, we'll turn it over to Megan, who's going to do a great job for you.
Ms. Martin.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Gibson and board members. Megan Martin with the Planning Department. The project before you is an appeal of a tentative parcel map and development plan and coastal development permit approved by the Subdivision Review Board. The proposed project includes the subdivision of a 6,000-square-foot parcel into two 3,000-square-foot parcels as a planned development, subsequent construction of two single-family residences on those parcels to be used as two separate vacation rentals. The project site is located within the village of Avila Beach within the urban reserve line. It is located along what is known as the colony lots within the residential multifamily land use category. The project site is currently vacant and lies between Avila Beach Drive and Colony Lane. As proposed, there will be no vehicle access off of Avila Beach Drive. It will solely be off of Colony Lane. The proposed tentative parcel map again includes a lot split into two equal-sized 3,000-square-foot lots. The development plan would subsequently allow the construction of two 1,950-square-foot single-family residences. The red box shows the total gross floor area proposed for the project at approximately 3,900 square feet, or 65% of the lot, and the blue denotes the two guest parking spots that have been included as part of the project description, and the gray is the open area at 2,400 square feet. And this shows you a better example of a top-down look through the proposed residence. The two vehicles in Unit B show that two vehicles would be able to fit into the proposed garage of both units, and the blue box again denotes the additional guest parking spaces off of Beach Colony Lane. Gives you an idea of the south and east elevation of the proposed project. North and west, and again, the garage doors will be facing and are perpendicular to Beach Colony Lane. So the project history involves the approval of the lots was by a lot line adjustment approved in 1998, and again, it's known as the Colony Lots. The proposed project was accepted for processing May 9th, and the Subdivision Review Board approved the proposed project on October 6th. The appeal was submitted by Avila Valley Advisory Council on October 13th, 2014.
So the first appeal issue within AVAC's appeal application was that there was no description of the common area elements. The common area elements were graphically shown on the approved site plan as well as discussed in the conditions of approval. A second appeal issue was that the side setbacks were inconsistent with Title 23. As a planned development, our ordinance provides for flexibility of those standards and is not subject to the standards set forth in Title 23. The proposed 3-foot setbacks comply with the minimum required setbacks set forth in Title 23 of our CZLUO. The third appeal issue was the land division should not have been approved prior to the development plan. The development plan is what authorizes the plan development subdivision. So what, in other words, the development plan had to be approved first in order to allow for the plan development subdivision to allow those smaller lot sizes, the 3,000 square foot lot sizes. And also at the October 6th, 2014 Subdivision Review Board hearing, the development plan was read into record and approved prior to the tentative parcel map. Appeal Issue 4, the appellant states that Section 2304.028 does not regulate the side setbacks. This is correct. However, this came after discussion with the appellant where it was thought this project was a common wall development. The proposed project is not common wall development, which would require an increased side setback of 5 feet. The staff report was stating that as a planned development, the section of the ordinance that would regulate side setbacks within the residential multifamily land use category is this section, 2304.028. Because that section of the ordinance is silent on setbacks, staff looked to the 10% of the lot width to a minimum of three feet within the coastal zone land use ordinance. Planned developments by design have more flexibility with setbacks, and as such, the applicant is proposing the side setback to be 3 feet. The fifth appeal issue was that the project exceeded the maximum floor area. The proposed project meets the 65% floor area requirement per the floor plan submitted for approval. Part of that appeal issue was also that the open area required for plan developments was not met. However, the applicant included 2 additional guest parking spots and removed those from the open area or common area calculations, and as such, they meet that minimum open area requirement of 40%. The sixth appeal issue related to the project requiring a guest parking space. Staff has recognized that an additional guest parking space that needed to be removed from the open area calculation was needed, and that change was made and is shown in the revised findings and conditions. And also, the applicant has agreed to include an additional guest parking space for Unit B as well as for Unit A. The seventh appeal issue is that garage access should not be perpendicular to Colony Lane. As proposed, the drive approach or garage access is at a 60-degree angle. The drive approach meets the minimum 14-foot aisle width requirement as well as the minimum 8-foot space width requirement as required by our ordinance. The applicant was also able to show using their ASHTO 2011 models that the turning radius for 2 vehicles approaching in 2 different fashions would be able to access the garage off of Colony Lane. The eighth appeal issue was that the use of the single-family dwelling as a vacation rental should not have been allowed. So what is before you today as a figure are all of the existing vacation rentals or proposed vacation rentals within Avila Beach Urban Reserve line. There is a total of 58. The blue shows those that have been approved by a zoning clearance. The red shows those that have been approved by a minor use permit. The purple shows those that have been approved but are not yet developed. And the green is the subject site. Staff looked at 2 themes when deciding whether this location was ideal for a vacation rental use. The first was whether this development and use would be compatible with the surrounding neighborhood and uses. These 2 photographs show 2 alternative colony lots that are currently being developed for the future use as vacation rentals. Staff also made the determination that this location is unique and more suitable for vacation rentals and that it's surrounded by recreation and visitor-serving amenities. You have the golf course. You have the Bob Jones Trail. It's adjacent to parking lot uses. It's adjacent to other 11 existing vacation rental uses. There's two hotels, the community center, and the post office. Lastly, the property fronts the main arterial that accesses Avila Beach, and that's Avila Beach Drive. The final appeal issue was that the side setbacks should be landscaped. As proposed, the applicants have submitted a landscaping plan, and they submitted that as required by the CZLUO. The proposed project complies with the landscaping standards of the Coastal Zone Land Use Ordinance. In summary, staff finds that the proposed plan development adheres to Title 23 development standards, is compatible with surrounding uses and development. It is proposed in a unique location suitable for vacation rental uses. And with the addition of the two parking spots, staff has included revised Exhibit B conditions of approval. With that said, staff recommends the board adopt and instruct the chairperson to sign the resolution partially upholding and partially denying the appeal of the Avila Valley Advisory Council, adopt the proposed mitigated negative declaration pursuant to the California Environmental Quality Act, affirm in part and modify the decision of the Subdivision Review Board, and conditionally approve the application of Damian and Catherine Mavis and Patrick Arnold for a development plan, coastal development permit, and the tentative parcel map based on the revised findings and revised conditions. As such, where the revised findings, item H, would be changed to include what is outlined in red as well as underlined. Staff would like clarification as to whether these need to be read into record or whether is it suitable to just show the board? Okay.
Yeah, okay. I'm sorry. Was she addressing me? I'm here intently reading on it. I got it. It's in the record, okay. As far as I'm concerned. I think we'll let the presentation you make here be the record. A copy to the clerk will do it.
Okay. Revised conditions of approval, Exhibit B, to include subsection D of Condition 13, as well as the revised conditions of approval in Exhibit D for the tentative parcel map, to include items F and G of the condition of approval 15. With that said, this concludes staff's presentation, and I'm available for any questions you may have.
Good. Thank you, Ms. Martin. Mr. Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a couple of questions. You know, for me, it really boils down to the policy. And here we have an exception to the vacation ordinance. And in this case, in order to have side-by-side vacation rental units, they went through the development process for the PUD, and then they went through did they have to further go through a MUP to get to the, or the development plan sufficed?
The development plan suffices.
Okay. So either one of those will get an applicant to the possibility of asking for an exception to the sort of 50-foot radius thing that we have. So I guess the question is, and I've been thinking about this, and I've talked to staff about it, and the reason why, for my own colleagues' benefit, why the findings have been hopefully improved upon to some degree is because I asked County Council about the findings of the unique area, which is essentially, and that's what I'm getting to. I know that this is now becoming an incredibly leading question, which I'm losing track of too. Is the main reason that the Subdivision Review Board came to approve this because of the location itself? Meaning, you know, there's a lot of vacation rentals throughout our community in Avila, more so in District 2 in Cambria and Cayucas, where I think probably the largest number are. And that's why for years, you know, staff worked very hard and worked with Coastal to come up with something that made sense, is essentially the reason to be able to contravene this policy to grant an exception because of the location?
Yes,
why don't you answer the question?
Yes, that's correct.
Well, then I guess the next question.
Next question for myself. Maybe you can ask the question.
How do we avoid there being, you know, because one of the, I think the points that the folks who are appealing have made is that, you know, it can create a precedence that anybody might be able to opt to, you know, to do. I'm assuming we have not allowed this before. We haven't seen either development plans or MUPs in other areas with a vacation rental ordinance that has allowed ones to go next to each other like this. Do we have any stats on that, Bill?
Thank you, Chairman Gibson. Bill Robeson, County Planning. We have seen this occurrence once before in Avalos, where we've gone through the minor use permit and waived the requirement. The most recent ones, though, that we've seen are in the commercial area, the last two.
Mm-hmm.
So we haven't had to change that requirement. There's no 50-foot requirement in that zoning category. But, yes, the minor use permit does allow for that exception to take place.
And do you know what the criteria previously was for the one in Avalon? This criteria seems to be the uniqueness of the location.
Right. It has to do with the surroundings. So we do look at them on a case-by-case basis. And one of the cases, it was kind of bordered by commercial retail area. The properties were kind of disjointed, so there wasn't a real connection between those two pieces of property. But we look at the location standards, we look at the impact on the neighbors, and we try to consider those in the evaluation of the project.
Okay, that's I think that's my current questions for myself.
Thank you. Ms. Ray.
Can you take a look at the, I think it was the third or fourth slide that you had, floor area coverage, please? Backwards one or two. That one. I'm having trouble seeing how gross floor area can be 65% and open area can be 40%. Can you explain that to me?
I realized when I created this Supervisor Ray. I realized when I created this slide that it would appear that the percentages do not add up. However, gross floor area includes every floor of the residence.
Oh, so is there an overhang?
Yes, gotcha. So there's an overhang.
Great. Thank you.
And I wonder, while we're here, if we could go back to the aerial that shows the existing vacation rentals. So in the area that's marked 3, there are a whole bunch of blue markings there that suggest a vacation rentals approved by zoning clearance. Were those approved under the current vacation rental ordinance?
It was before.
Okay, so
there's
those
a total of 11
grandfathered in.
Yes.
All right. And does site number 2, which is the subject site at all, is it closer than 50 feet to any of those blue areas? I guess my question is, under the current vacation rental ordinance, would site 2 qualify at all for vacation rentals by being too close to existing vacation rentals?
It is within 50 feet of the existing and grandfathered in.
So to get any vacation rentals on that site, we're going to need
either a development plan, or if they had not chosen to apply for one currently, in the future they could have come in for a minor use permit.
Okay. And could you refresh my memory on the land use categories of the colony lots? As I remember, there's a couple different zonings there.
Yes. So half are zoned recreation, and the other half are zoned residential multifamily.
And within your colleagues who are much, much longer in service, is there any rationale for why that's the case?
From my research, what I've been able to find is within the Avila Beach specific plan, it first showed this area as a linear park that would buffer between the uses south of that strip. However, they came in with the zoning change as well as the lot line adjustment that created the configuration you see before you. The recreation land use category provides the opportunity to still have single-family residences developed on it, but the residential multifamily would allow for increased density. So you have the ability to develop
a wider range of housing options for buyers and developers.
I should have come to you first on that one, obviously. So, Mr. Meacham?
So is this the only reason that we're dealing with an appeal is because it says vacation rental on it?
I think that there were some discrepancies with whether or not this development was considered a common wall development. So there were issues with whether or not this was consistent with our ordinance related to side setbacks as well as the vacation rental issue and compatibility with the community of Avila Beach in general.
You just mentioned it's zoned for multifamily.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Hill? Jim?
Yeah, if we could just go back to that, Megan, that same overhead map that had the different clearances and existing vacation rentals, please. Because I wanted to just clarify something that the chair brought up. So with the ones that had already been approved before the vacation ordinance had gone in order for them to even get the one, let's go away from what they're asking for, which is two, would they have to apply for a MUP to just have the one vacation rental ordinance in order? Because they're grandfathered in to at least allow them to what? That's what I'm trying to understand, the how the policy from before enacted.
Yes, within 50 feet.
Right. So if it's within 50 feet of anyone that's even that existed before the ordinance, any
that's
new
right.
one
yes.
since the ordinance would have to apply for go through the MUP to even have one. And in this case, they did a development plan because they want to do the two units in the PUD and do them. Okay.
All right, very good. Thank you very much. With that, and no further questions from the dais, we'll open it to presentation by the appellant at this point. And however many folks want to speak on behalf of the appellant, we'll give you a block of 10 minutes, and happy to take your comments.
My name is Jim Hartig. I'm the current chairperson of the Avila Valley Advisory Council, AVAC. Representing the residents of the town of Avila Beach regarding this project. First of all, I would like to state that the residents of Avila Beach are not against a project on this lot. We would just like a project that follows the rules. As staff has pointed out, our appeal points, I won't go into those, we'll just kind of summarize the issues with Title 23. This colony project looks like a condominium project, and it feels like a condominium project to us, but it has been approved by the Subdivision Review Board as a planned unit development. This gets them around a lot of these Title 23 issues that we're talking about. It also requires covenants, conditions, and restrictions for this two-lot subdivision, the establishment of a homeowners association in compliance with the California Civil Code. If the association is incorporated, then it will also be subjected to the conditions of the California Corporation Code. There will also be a subdivision public report issued by the Commissioner of California Department of Real Estate pursuant to the California Subdivided Lands Act. This seems like a lot of extra burden on government just to get around Title 23. AVAC opposes this manipulation to avoid the conditions in Title 23 for a condominium project where it is not in compliance. The real issue, as you seem to have picked up on, is the issue of the vacation rentals. Prior to the Avila Beach oil spill cleanup, Avila Beach was a community. It was a neighborhood where the majority of the residents, even rental residents, were full-time residents. The Avila Beach-specific plan was created after the cleanup to help return Avila Beach to a community. This has not happened due to the over-invasive number of vacation rentals that have taken the place of full-time permit or development plan. The Subdivision Review Board has eliminated the location distance, which is contrary to the Title 23 ordinance. We feel strongly that Avila Beach is at a tipping point of no return regarding the loss of full-time residents to vacation rentals. Allowing this project to have two vacation rentals will set a horrible precedent regarding future development on the remaining Colony Lane lots and will further degrade the community of Avila Beach into a ghost town of no full-time residents. In summary, AVAC strongly urges the board to deny approval of the Colony Lot 11, instruct the Subdivision Review Board to approve the project as a condominium project subject to Title 23 and approve only one vacation rental for the two parcel lots.
Any further of the appellants are welcome to use the existing time at this point.
Thank you.
It's a privilege to speak before this board, and we so appreciate that you've done homework on this project and for this appeal. Especially want to thank our supervisor, Adam Hill. He was instrumental in Avila Beach getting a vacation rental ordinance after our 10-year struggle. Kudos to you for that, Adam. We are here for the love of Avila Beach, not for money. We don't get paid to do this. There is a larger picture that we would like to have considered. This project will have a domino effect on the remaining 11 lots in the Colony Project. It will open the way for unchallengeable increases on the numbers of vacation units and will violate the county's vacation rental ordinance. Sadly, what is missing from our community is affordable housing for the people who work in Avila Beach. More vacation rentals won't solve that problem. The Board of Supervisors developed and approved the Avila Beach Specific Plan in 2000. It was the culmination of work from a whole community who had been devastated by the Unocal cleanup. The railroad right-of-way, now the Colony, was included in the specific plan, half recreation and half multifamily residential. It was envisioned as a landscaper buffer from Avila Beach Drive and also to the parking lot in Avila Beach. As you know, there's only one road in and out of Avila Beach. It's a huge issue for everything that happens there. In 2000, when the specific plan was developed, they estimated 800,000 to 1 million visitors a year coming to Avila. And you and I know that that number is likely nowhere close a million now because we've become such a popular tourist destination. We planned for 935 parking places in the specific plan, and of those, 250 are on the Colony route, Avila Beach Drive. Vacation rentals could absorb some of these on-street parking places, restricting access for visitors. And while vacation rentals are required to have off-street parking, we all know that we all park where it's most convenient at any time of any day. We have no way to enforce that they'll keep their cars off of Avila Beach Drive. The residents of Avila Beach recognized as early as 2003, when Avila began reconstruction, that more residential properties were being developed for use as vacation rentals. Attempts by the Avila Valley Advisory Council in 2005 to be included in the countywide vacation rental ordinance were blocked by our then county supervisor and developers. Without these regulations, the very thing that made Avila so special was compromised by the loss of families in our community. Our community saw then that uncontrolled vacation rentals was the antithesis of everything that was needed to create the fabric of our community. Unfortunately, this has nearly been lost through this transition. The CSD in Avila Community Services District serves 337 bills each month, and of those, 163 are mailed to the Avila zip code. The assumption can be made that 174 units are part-time residential, 80% of those are minimum water users. So essentially, no one's living in Avila. There is currently no way to enforce a vacation rental ordinance per 23 except through the efforts of the community reporting code enforcement violations. But still, as you saw on the map, that planning has MUPs for 58 total vacation rentals in Avila. If each of the 11 Colony lots were allowed to be developed as plan unit developments, there would be a total increase of 38% as a condo project without vacation rentals. Thanks.
Thank you. And ma'am, your name for the record?
Oh, I'm sorry. Carla Bittner.
Okay, thank you very much.
An Avila resident.
All right. Thank you very much. With that, we'll go to a 10-minute block for the applicant or representative. Ms. Kirk.
Good afternoon, Chairman Gibson and members of the board. My name is Jamie Kirk, and I am here representing Damian Mavis and Pat Arnold. this afternoon, and I do have probably about a 7-minute presentation, much of it focusing on the concern of the vacation rental. With that, as staff indicated, this is one parcel of 14 that exist from a lot line adjustment that was recorded in 1998. And what I've highlighted on this exhibit is showing where the multifamily land use category is in relation to the lots. There are 6 lots within the multifamily and 8 lots within the recreation land use category. And our request is to subdivide the existing 6,000 square foot parcel into 2 parcels of 3,000 square foot each using the plan development provisions contained in the Coastal Zone Land Use Ordinance, which include the incorporation of common use areas and common maintenance areas, and construct 2 single family residences and allow the option to use those single family residences as vacation rentals in the future. And Ms. Martin has addressed the appeal issues at length, so I've condensed most of them to one slide. As far as the side setbacks, we conform to the requirements of the Coastal Zone Land Use Ordinance. We have side setbacks between 3 to 5 feet, so much of the buildings actually are have 5-foot side setbacks. We comply with the floor area requirements. We comply with the open area requirements, even backing out the Colony Lane access easement, which we're not required to do, but we did want to demonstrate that we comply with the open area requirements backing that area out because we know that was a concern. We heard parking as a concern. There are a total of 6 spaces provided on site, 2 in each garage and 1 in front of the garages. And as far as compatibility, the project is consistent with existing anticipated future development. One of the concerns brought up in the appeal was the massing of the structure, the size of the structure, the lot coverage. And it's important to note, in our land use category, the multifamily, the height limitation is 25 feet. And whenever you move over to the recreation land use category, that height increases to 35 feet. So whenever you're driving down Avalo Beach Drive, just based on the height limitation in the multifamily, and these houses will appear much smaller than those adjacent to it. So in regards to the vacation rental, 2 issues. The first issue was inadequate parking. There was not going to be sufficient parking for the vacation rental. As we have demonstrated, there are 2 spaces in each garage and opportunity for a guest parking space in front of the garage. So we've provided the parking, and the garage entry is angled per AVAC request. We originally had the garage entry or the parking driveway going perpendicular, and that was modified to be diagonal in response to their comments. And I think this gets to the issue of the day, is whether or not granting modification to this modification to the locational standard will be precedent setting. And our response in how do we make the findings for this project is that this project and this site is unique. It's a duplex project, and it's unique, thereby making the 50-foot distance separation between the vacation rentals unnecessary and ineffective. The appeal seems to infer that the 50-foot separation standard is mandated. It is not. It is a standard, but the vacation rental ordinance was adopted to allow modification on site-specific review, and that's through a minor use permit approval. And whenever you look at the general purpose of residential vacation standards, I think that sets forth what your board should be looking at if you are going to approve a modification to this standard. And what the language says is that if you're going to approve a modification to these standards, you should look at minimizing impacts to existing residential neighborhoods and thereby finding that the use is compatible with the surrounding residential uses, the use will not act to harm or alter a neighborhood, and if there is a concentration of uses, there will not be an effect on adjacent full-time residents. And so let's look at the surrounding uses. Our highlighted in yellow is the project site, and we've got San Luis Bay Drive coming in, 2 residences under construction, both with approved vacation rentals, 9 approved vacation rentals adjacent. We have a community center, we have a hotel, parking lot, central business district, and the park. So when we're looking at whether or not this use is compatible with surrounding residential uses, the all developed residential parcels adjacent to the property are approved for vacation rental use. Therefore, we are compatible with the adjacent residential uses, and the closest non-vacation rental residential property is more than 130 feet from the project site. Okay, but I think we need to talk about the Coastal Act and how this property actually implements the policies contained in both our local coastal plan and the Coastal Act. Section 30222 of the Coastal Act puts the priority of visitor-serving uses over private residential uses. So whereas our multifamily land use designation drives the residential use of the property, it also allows for visitor-serving uses via the vacation rental. So I think implementing the project with the vacation rental is consistent with the policies of the Coastal Act, our local coastal plan policies. And whenever you read the area plan language in the San Luis Bay Coastal Area Plan regarding multifamily, there's actually language that specifically encourages mixed uses in the multifamily, including visitor-serving uses where appropriate. And we think when looking at Avila, this this site and the colony lots kind of meet that requirement. In conclusion, I think we've gone through it. We comply with all of the requirements. And I would like to touch on kind of a process standpoint. Whenever staff had the exhibit showing the zoning clearances and the minor use permits and what's been approved, our experience has been for a time there was vacation rentals in Avila were just approved by vacation or just by zoning clearance. And then there became a shift where, oh, wait, we might not have been doing this right. They're an S use. And then it required every application to come through for a minor use permit. And so now the ordinance was adopted. It was adopted in November of 2013. And so now we're coming in for the minor use permit, requesting a modification. We're allowed to request it per the ordinance as it was written and adopted and vetted through the Coastal Commission. And with that, we would request that the board deny the appeal and adopt the staff recommendation with the conditions as amended as well as the augmented findings. We think those findings are very important to incorporate into the approval today. That includes my comments, and I'm available for questions as well as the owners are present as well as our representatives from Above Grade Engineering.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Kirk.
Thanks.
Appreciate it. With that then, and seeing no questions coming for either applicant or appellant, we'll go ahead and open it to the general public at 3-minute commentary. I have two such requests, one from Ann Brown and the other from Mary Matakovich. Or Matakovich. Matakovich. Should have been.
Probably. Good afternoon. I'm Ann Brown. I'm a permanent resident of Avila. And I appreciate Chair Gibson asking pertinent questions. Thank you. I appear before you in support of the appeal, which Jim Hartig, our AVAC chair, and Carla Bitten have outlined. As a permanent resident of Avila since 2002 and property owner since 1967, my major concern is allowing two contiguous vacation rentals in direct opposition to the vacation rental ordinance. Avila residents worked hard for 8 years to include Avila in the 2013 ordinance. This ordinance addresses the number of occupants, parking only on site, minimum 7-day stay, and noise levels. Most of the vacation rentals do not have a minor use permit, which would allow collecting TOT for the county. And it would activate the legal process. To comply with the ordinance and a review of vacation websites shows Avila houses listed unknown to the county process. And I have to say that that map that shows in purple the vacation rentals, there are many more in the community. That's just the tip of the iceberg. The rental house across the street for me, for instance, is one example. They can park in the garage. They can park in the driveway. And usually their street parking is being used, which actually means that people who come for day use of Avila and the beach don't find parking. It's taken up by the folks who are vacation rental use. Losing permanent workforce housing in Avila has created the situation of not having enough residents provide community stewardship upon which tourists rely. The CSD, for instance, the Community Service District, those folks are recycled. There aren't enough people in Avila to fill. It's true of AVAC, too. There aren't enough people living in Avila to be able to work Avila as a town. The county has weathered the recession and states it is in good financial shape. I think I've heard that from you, haven't I, Adam? I suggest that planning hire additional code enforcement.
Staff report, it has a lot of conditions regarding the management, the parking, those sorts of controls that I think the residents of Avila are looking for on vacation rentals. So with us following the correct process, bringing the vacation rental forward with the application as we're building, you know, being clear about what our approach is and what the true intent of the project is and being willing to take on those conditions. Our owners are being responsible in wanting to have property, own their property and have it be operated and not have a detrimental effect on the community. And then going back to the findings for the vacation rental, when you look at, as I included in my presentation, the modification to the locational standard is to protect those existing residential neighborhoods. And I think as we've shown, this property is unique enough. You know, we're not putting a vacation rental in the middle of a developed single-family residential neighborhood with full-time residences. The colony lots are very unique in that they're mixed zone, the multifamily and the recreation, and that if there were to be vacation rentals in Avila, this seems to be the appropriate place for them to occur. And that concludes my comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kirk. And then a five-minute block for the appellants if they would desire closing comments.
I'll be very brief. I think I would just summarize and say that, you know, we can find a lot of loopholes and a lot of ways to contrive and manipulate a process and makes it look like it's okay to do it, but the real question is it really the right thing to do?
All right, Mr. Hartig, thank you very much. We'll then close it to the public comment and those of the appellant and the applicants and bring it back to the board for deliberation. Mr. Hill, would you like to lead off here?
Sure. Well, I think you can hear from particularly the two folks that presented from my advisory council that there's a host of issues that stem all the way back from the oil spill, tearing down of the town, the reconstruction of the town. I've spent a lot of I was good when I first moved to this county about 20 years ago. Before all of that happened, I lived in South County, I lived in Pismo, and I had a good friend who lived in Avila, and so I kind of went through the whole reconstruction thing. The truth is that the town did redevelop in a way that some people who had great affection for it and even lived there, you know, weren't always thrilled with, because it was a funky beach town that previous to that had been an industrial oil town. Some of the things that the county had been able to secure for the community, certainly before I ever not only served in this office but ever even was crazy enough to think about it, were things like the People's Self-Help Housing Project that exists there, the community park that exists there, the Marine Center, a whole bunch of other things. The county was pretty strong in trying to do as much as they could, but, you know, you can't put a town back into what it was in time. And so I would say it's pretty true in terms of the description that most of what occurs in downtown, what we call downtown Avila, is visitor serving, and that most of the full-time residents live either in the estates or in the canyons. It's probably as it has been even before the teardown from our numbers that show, too. But some of these issues really aren't necessarily the most relevant ones here, because to me it's really about whether an exception should be granted on the vacation rental ordinance. And I've wrestled with this, and that's why I worked with staff a bit to see how that could possibly happen. And if you look at the purpose of the vacation rental ordinance, it does seem to suggest to me that the purpose is, and I should also say as a rewind to history, that the first 2 years that I served on the board, 2009-2010, I asked AVAC if they wanted to be included in the vacation rental ordinance, and they declined. And we have that in the record. So quite sensitively, the reasons was that they were concerned about the economic impacts. Obviously, the recession was hitting a lot of people hard. So back to the purpose of the vacation rental. And I think Ms. Brown's probably right. My office, particularly Ms. Miller, has struggled at times working with Mr. Our whole code enforcement staff sometimes on certain issues. I think that we try to do the best we can when there have been. It is a complaint-driven process, so we don't. Even if we had more people, we're not going to start looking around to see who's violating this or that, because I think it would create a host of other problems. But Mr. Robeson can attest to the fact that, you know, on occasion we have been very clear about the nuisances that may be caused and even some illegality in terms of not having the proper licensing or clearances, which we won't tolerate. So back to this question. My sense is I'm leaning towards granting it because I don't know who would be negatively impacted, and I'm not sure what a stance against it does for the community of Avila or anything else. There is an exception process. If the ordinance didn't allow an exception process, we would say, well, it's pretty clear. But it allows an exception process, and it allows an exception process through the development plan or the MUP. In this case, the location and the uniqueness of the location, which probably a lot of people wouldn't even know that those are lots. I probably didn't know for a long time. It looks like a right-of-way almost. It's not going to impact some existing residential neighborhoods and create the kind of friction that we have ordinance to try to temper. And so I'm not sure what is really gained. It's not... And I would disagree with Professor Hartig. I don't think it's a manipulation of the process if you go through the process that is part of the ordinance. And that's what's occurred here. Would I be favorable toward it if they're looking for two vacation rentals next to each other in an existing residential neighborhood? Yeah, I would. I would, because then I would think it would be unfair to the residents. I don't know who they would be protecting at this point. That would be, you know, that could somehow find this to be unfair to their rights. A lot of the people who live, I don't know that there's that many people that are still left that used to live downtown, but I understand the disappointment that comes when, you know, it was a traumatic situation. You know, the entire, you know, beachfront promenade was torn down and a lot of work had to be done, and I think that there's been a fair amount of time, but there's still a struggle in some people's minds about what should be downtown. It does seem to be more visitor serving. For probably about 4 or 5 months of year, it's very busy with people visiting, and then it goes back to being very, very, very quiet. And most of the businesses on the promenade can't really make it. They struggle to make it. There's very few that are able to be secure in that. And there's not really a workforce in the sense that we try to provide workforce housing in Avila. The workforce is at the nuclear power plant. Some people have chosen that are employees of PG&E to live in the Bay of States and to live in the canyons, but I don't know many that are concerned about the downtown as providing the kind of workforce housing that has been recommended. So I guess, again, because of the uniqueness of this, and they have provided the parking as was asked for by staff, I'm leaning in favor of it with the understanding that, you know, there continues to exist issues among some of my advisory council that really have nothing to do with this specific. If nothing happened on this lot, those issues would still exist. People would still be unhappy with parking and sometimes with traffic and sometimes with whether there are enough, families. I don't know how you're going to resolve those things by this particular project, but I don't think that anything – I think they've gone through the process as their agent says, and they have been willing to make the changes that staff has asked for. So that's where I'm leading, unless otherwise persuaded, towards granting it.
Oh, I will be happy to offer you some thoughts on the other side of that argument, Mr. Hill, but it turns out all our other colleagues have their lights on. So we'll go to Supervisor Ray and then Supervisor Arnold.
I asked the applicant this question yesterday, so I wanted to, and they seemed favorable, so I'm going to ask it to you. Under the CCNRs, there's a list of what you'd like to have as planning in the CCNRs, and one of the things that I would like to see in there is a condition that those garages remain as parking spaces. And often they, you know, a pool table gets put in there or a ping pong table or something. The applicant didn't seem to have any problem with that. I can see her saying no, but I'd like to see that delineated in there to make sure that we protect the parking.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes, there was another slide you had, Megan, and it showed, it was a line, but it showed beyond the recreational and residential on the colony lots. It went all the way through town. It had a big line through the, do you remember which one that was? I was hoping to revisit. I think it was one of your slides. Yeah, it was that one. So thank you for pulling that up again. It looks to me in the day when this was kind of designed in the residential multifamily that we see on the right, that obviously has changed, and we see a lot of vacation rentals in that category now. So to me, it looks like even when the vacation rental ordinance process was being dealt with, there was purposefully left some flexibility so that you could look at each lot in this area or throughout Avila, lot by lot, in making
points. One in particular is the issue of location, a unique location. The second one, and Ms. Brown raised this point about a lot of others aren't playing by the rules. These folks are actually coming forward supposedly playing by the rules in terms of what they're going to provide and are going to have to adhere to in terms of the conditions. To me, that's a lot better than maybe a multifamily unit was going to be built, and then all of a sudden they started renting that out as a vacation rental, and we got a real problem on our hands. So to me, they met the conditions. They have done everything I think that they have been asked to do because of its location, and I don't see the impact to any residential area in that particular area either. So those are my comments. I'll wait for the motion.
Thank you, Mr. Meacham. Well, I've been dealing with vacation rentals for more than the time that I've been in office. And just to give you some perspective, within the communities of Cambria and Cayucas, there are upwards of 500 and approaching 600 licensed vacation rentals at this point. I think it's useful to understand the intent behind the vacation rental ordinance, which is the means by which zoning clearances are now granted under a certain set of standards. It is really to address the balance between this commercial use being visited into lands that are zoned for commercial use into lands zoned for residential use. It is not simply about the friction. The friction is the friction of sometimes permanent neighbors and sometimes temporary neighbers of noise.
Can you elaborate on
well,
the zoning?
Well, the friction you reference is
no, I know what you're saying.
Party. But it also is the question of whether we're going to preserve a stock of long-term rental housing, permanent rental housing. And I think the argument that the necessity to preserve long-term rental housing is a very important one. And the question, we have two serious questions of policy before us here today. I know applicants who bring forward permit applications don't necessarily want to have policy discussions, but the question of granting an exception to this residential vacation rental ordinance, which was absorbed hundreds of hours of community time in trying to craft, is a really important one. It also speaks to the question of whether we are going to abandon the idea that we're going to try to have permanent residential uses within the community, the village of Avila. So the residential vacation ordinance that exists has operational standards that speak to the nuisances, the vacation rentals, but it also very fundamentally speaks to the balance between how many we should have in a community. And in Cambria and Cayucas, in my estimation, we have more than we should have. It has caused profound changes to the character of these neighborhoods, of these communities. And in Cayucas in particular, I happen to know that probably 15 years ago or 20 years ago, Cayucas School had 300-plus kids in it, K through 8. Today it has barely 200. Yes, housing prices have a change to that, but also the long-term residential rental market has dried up in Cayucas. It has simply dried up, as we've seen the number of residential vacation rental units rise and the number of second homes rise. So it is absolutely built into that ordinance that there shall be an exception that can be sought through a minor use permit or, in this case, a development plan. So that's a reasonable question. But the granting of that is not simply that it be not detrimental to the health, safety, and welfare or the orderly development of the neighborhood. It has to do with the unique situation of the particular parcel. So let's examine the arguments of uniqueness of this particular parcel. And with all due respect to Ms. Kirk, I'm not persuaded by the arguments that she put forth, except perhaps partially by one of them. She put forth that this was unique because it was a duplex. No, there are many duplexes here. She put forward the idea that this was already surrounded by vacation rentals. Well, that's sort of a circular argument that says, as we got vacation rentals, we should have more vacation rentals, but the vacation rental ordinance actually speaks to seek a balance. She put forward the idea it's unique because it is a developing, and yeah, there are a lot of vacant lots here, but again, we go back to the question of, do we want them all developed as vacation rentals, or do we want them have some amount of permanent long-term housing there? She put forward the idea that it's close to the Central Business District. Well, that's Cayucas. Everything is close to the Central Business District if you're willing to put on your tennis shoes and walk. And that was another argument, that it was walking distance. And then the question of the visitor serving intent of portions of the Coastal Act and our LCP was a very selective reading of that particular clause. And if you look between what was highlighted, that whole section said that it was private land suitable for commercial recreational facilities. That doesn't speak to me to RMF zoned land. Possibly the rec
calculation.
So we don't. The other question is, do we know what the potential for future vacation rental applications is under the ordinance, or with this exception?
Not to my knowledge, no.
So for those are the reasons right here that I am I'm deeply concerned about granting an exception.
Can I ask you then,
sure.
when is it that an exception could possibly be granted? Because you say in your district you could never foresee it because there's just already too many.
Let me
generally said that.
No, well, I haven't said that.
So, I mean, what would it? I guess the question is, what criteria would have to be met? Because the ordinance allows for an exception for a reason. If it didn't allow for an exception, I said, we wouldn't
right.
be here.
Right.
So it allows for an exception. What would the criteria possibly be? Because yours is based on some things that aren't necessarily supported, that
yep.
there's a lack of, or that you can somehow magically make housing affordable to certain people if you don't allow it to be something else.
Well, the affordability is a separate question. My concern is this. That if we grant an exception, we've got to be cognizant of the implications of granting that exception in a lot of different places that we haven't studied before at this time. And we have ample vacation rental opportunities in Cayucas and Cambria right now. The distance criteria is very rarely met in order to establish a new one. I don't think we're short of vacation rentals at that level. I think the bigger issue is, what do we envision for Avalon? I mean, are we simply going to give up on the idea that we should have more permanent residential options in Avalon? And we talk a lot about workforce housing.
How do you get to that? How do you actually make permanent residential housing if you don't own it? Meaning the county doesn't own it.
Right.
The one opportunity that the county had to insist
right.
on permanent housing that be set aside for people was the People's Self-Help Project. That's the only one that I mean, so how does, for instance, if you were to say, we're not going to allow any more vacation rentals, we're not going to allow any more of those to exist in Avila because we think there's too many, then how are we going to insist that those people be rented to somehow the That's people that you would find somehow the housing that would be that you would find more appealing, which would be
so let me jump
people who could afford.
Well, let me jump in on that.
A certain entry
so
level.
So the question of is not the not my intent to say there shall be no more vacation rentals established in Avila Beach. The question is, are we seeking the proper balance between and do we want any long-term residential
options in Avila. It's that simple. Now, the affordability is a separate question. The question of do we do it, and the way we do it, and you'd asked in the way we do it, is that we zone land. We zone land for commercial because we want to see opportunities for commercial. We zone land for residential. We zone land for public facilities. That's the very essence of our land use zoning practice, is to encourage the right mix of uses within each community. And so my concern is if we grant the exception on this location, we have tilted the scales very seriously. And, again, I'm not looking at the intent language of the general plan. I'll yield the floor to Mr. Meacham.
Jump in on this conversation?
Well, it's a, yeah.
Thanks. I guess, conversely, if you looked at this and said that,
turn this on,
that we have a number of multifamily residents going in here, do we all of a sudden say no more of those?
No.
Well, I guess my point being is you can't make people build things that they can't either make money off of or afford to build. So I think if you're saying that we want to preserve this to make a balance of affordable housing, who's going to build it?
Well,
they're not building it now.
Well, it's Mr. Meacham, there's not evidence before me right now that denying the vacation rental use of this property would preclude making a profit on developing this parcel.
And I don't see a development project coming forward.
Well, they're asking for vacation rentals. Okay. I haven't heard them say if we don't get vacation rentals, we can't build the project. This is RMF land. People can build houses and rent them. People can build these PUDs and sell them. And so there's not evidence before me that says that denying the vacation rental use completely torpedoes this project.
Well, I have to disagree. I think that they've come forward with a project. They've come forward with and met the conditions. There are exceptions that can be provided in this, and I don't see us setting a precedent, if you will, basically because of the uniqueness of the site that I think Mr. Hill very adequately explained, and they've complied by all the rules. So I don't understand the reason.
Well, let me go to Ms. Ray. I'd be happy to go back and forth on this some more because yeah. I think there's a very important question.
I think the very important question is a matter of process. And right here, we're trying to decide if this applicant has gone through the process adequately or if the appellant's argument holds with regard to whether or not the conditions and the findings can be met. You're all arguing high-level policy, and we've gotten away from what...
On the coast. And therefore, everybody should have... The coast belongs to everybody in California, and we should have the right, including people who won't be able to afford to have a house anywhere in Avila, but might be able to afford to rent a house in Avila for a week with their family. And that's the reason for it. There's a lot of people who would love to have a second home, and do. They do in the residential areas. And I don't, in the Bay Estates, there's a lot of people who only have second homes. And I'm not convinced that that's the best thing. We don't try to, you know, stop that. People have the right to. And so I guess the question is, again, you're suggesting a preference, which I might agree with. You know, I would love to have, you know, affordable or workforce housing, for instance. That's what we're calling it now because there's not really any housing anywhere that anybody can afford if you don't have money already. But let's say, you know, people who are working, we would love to do that. But, the town changed significantly. And whether that was a good thing or a bad thing is beyond our ability to control it.
Okay.
And so in this particular instance, you're saying that I'm asking again, like, under what circumstances would an exception be reasonable to you? Because if it's not reasonable in a strip on the busy one road that's backed by a community parking lot, other vacation rentals across from a golf course and has absolutely not even a stone's throw to what you can consider a residence, what would be an exception that would be reasonable?
So if you want to argue hypotheticals, we can construct
hypotheticals.
Well,
this hypothetical. One isn't, so what
would
be?
It's the matter of granting exception. I think the vacation rental ordinance was very carefully thought out, and whether you like a distance criterion as a means of setting the balance as to how many vacation rentals we have or you don't like it, that is the chosen methodology for doing that. The decision was made to scatter them if one were to develop from scratch. That was the idea, really. If you develop from scratch,
that there should be a separation. Separation provides operational benefits because you don't have a concentration of transient that would take over a neighborhood or something like that. Mm-hmm. Where would I grant an exception if you had, let's say, a particularly large lot that in Cambria you could buffer the vacation rental use against a potential vacation rental right next door? It was a unique structure in a unique physical location. That's a possibility. But going back to Supervisor Ray's, an applicant simply going through the process does not produce the approval of a project.
Because I agree.
Part of this process is rendering a judgment as to whether this is consistent with policies. And so whether we really like to discuss policy or not, in making these considered judgments, we have to consider what it's going to do. I've been making land use decisions now for most of 10 years in a formal role for the county, and longer than that in an advisory council role. Often when I make a land use decision, I visualize making 10 of the same land use decisions. And in this case, it's literally true. We grant this exception. The person from the parcel right next door to this one who comes in has no reason not to expect the same exception.
Except if that's a different...
So it's not unique. So by definition, this is not a unique situation. This is the giving over of the colony lots to vacation rentals because we believe that they're located in a part of the community. That, to me, is a decision we can make, and that may well be the decision this board does make, but I think we should be honest about what it means in terms of the policy implications. We talk a lot about workforce housing. Workforce housing depends a lot on having long-term rental stock. It absolutely does, because we know we can get people into houses that they rent easier than we can get in people in houses they can buy.
And where does workforce housing belong? In the places where the work exists.
Well, you
where
have
the employers are.
Okay.
I mean, I understand the argument when the argument's made in places like Slo City or Paso Robles, right, because they're the major employment centers. That seems to be a lot less relevant in tourist-serving beach towns.
Well, there are a lot of businesses in Avila Beach that serve tourists. Restaurants, bars, hotels, aquaria, or aquarium, at least one aquarium. There's a lot of economic activity there. There's presumably the need for people to manage that activity, to be employed in that activity. I think there's a perfectly reasonable case to be made that a long-term residential use in Avila is appropriate. And it's affordability, another question, but affordable by design.
You're suggesting that if you deny it, that's what the owners of the property are going to do. They're going to make it a long-term rental, and they're going to make it at a price that's going to be affordable to somebody who works in a restaurant or works in the hotel. That's a big assumption.
Well,
I mean, it's too big for me to make, because you're getting involved in market assumptions that don't make sense anywhere else in the county.
I can't command them to build at a certain price or rent at a certain price, because this is indeed restricted affordable housing.
Right.
But the
area, so... Those are my comments.
All right.
You got a motion, Mr. Hill?
Yeah, well, I just wanted to say, too, and one thing that I think is important is that, you know, almost all the time when people I have rarely encountered people who are strong advocates for workforce housing who already own their homes. I mean, let's be realistic. It becomes a way to joust away other projects that people, you know, would prefer not to see. There's only two ways to get workforce housing in a community like Avila. Increase by large the density, which I'm pretty sure if you were to increase the density to the point where you would have affordability start to happen, every single person would be against it because they all have homes and they don't want a lot of homes crowding them.
You can't supply your way out of this.
Well, they won't allow that either. So, you know, that's one thing. And the other thing is to actually buy the land and restrict it to workforce housing, which the county did assist people self-help in that one instance. This is not an instance when we have the ability to do that. So it's a stalking horse in that case.
Could I ask staff a question pertinent to that?
Sure.
Within the PUD ordinance, could more than two units be put on this parcel?
No, there is no. Okay.
That's all. Okay. Yeah. Go ahead.
So, with that said, you know, I understand what you're saying, and if this were in a different location, I would be against it. If I had people who lived in that neighborhood and said, you know, we've been here residences and we've had to deal with enough, you know, because you've had code enforcement out, et cetera, this is creating a burden on us that's not fair, I would agree, because I think there's an exception process that should only occur when you can say you can't foresee the kind of problems that we do have occurring in this particular place. And that's essentially why I'm, you know, if it were somewhere else, if it were in the Bay of States, if it were in the canyons where people live.
Yeah. Thank you.
So
thank you, Mr. Meacham. So go ahead.
And
with your
so, and I'm comfortable with the findings being changed to make it a little bit more clear in terms of the precedence. I mean, every decision, you know, there's a discretionary decision that we're not the Supreme Court. We don't have to rely on stare decisis and think we're making history if we approve one project and turn down another one. So I'm just going to say that I would move to uphold the staff recommendation, which does partially, and that's where I think the advisory council was of great help in terms of the parking in particular, does uphold and does turn down some of it, but I would uphold the staff's.
So you're going with staff's recommendation. Staff recommendation.
Can we please add in the restriction or the covenant that the garages stay open for parking?
Yeah.
Okay, so we have the motion on staff's recommendation with the addition on to the CCNRs, and Mr. Hill, would that include the revised findings that staff put forward? And if we could, then please have those revised findings back on the screen so we can look at them one more time and at a pace where my eyes can track them. So condition, if you could walk us through this, Ms. Martin, what the text in red says.
So this is attachment 4, conditions of approval, revised conditions of approval, exhibit D. And I'll call your attention to condition number 15, to amend the CCNRs to read item F, maintenance of guest parking spaces, as well as item G, residents shall park their vehicles in their garages. Sufficient space shall be reserved at all times for vehicle parking within the garages. Residents may use their garages for storage if sufficient space is reserved for vehicle parking.
Can you please delineate that needs to be for two vehicles?
Yes. Shall park.
You want to just write in there, no pool tables?
Maybe they can drop one down from the ceiling that when they're
for
gone.
Two vehicles per garage.
Per garage parking. Residents shall park their vehicles within their garages. Sufficient space shall be reserved at all times for vehicle parking within the garages. Residents may use their garages for storage if sufficient space is reserved for two vehicles per garage parking.
Okay. Reserved for garage. Parking, two okay. vehicles per garage. Fine. I think that beats it adequately to it. And then you had any other revised conditions? You did have a revised finding.
Yes. This is attachment 2, revised conditions of approval, exhibit B, and this is to modify condition number 13, item D, to include an additional item, and that's item D, where at least one guest parking space outside of the common use area, and submit revised calculations illustrating the proposed project meets the requirements for planned developments, maximum floor area versus minimum open area. And lastly, revise attachment 1, revised findings, exhibit A, to modify item H, where the modification of the location standard as set forth.
Yes, sir.
And the second agrees?
Yes, sir.
Under discussion,
sure.
First of all, I appreciate the opportunity to discuss this because I think there are some important ideas here. And with due respect to your position, which is well-reasoned, I won't support this motion because I think we are making a significant policy decision for this community of Avila Beach that is not contemplated in the LCP that's in place at this point. That said, I do so without rancor and pleased for the opportunity to air the question.
Maybe when you vote against, other times you have rancor.
Sometimes. heavily repressed rancor, but that's another. Those are other.
And you have to, you know, sometimes you got to let the policy guide you into the most pragmatic thing you can do, and you know, that's where I am.
Reasonable people can disagree. With that, Madam Clerk, if you're clear, I know staff will provide you the revised text. You can call the roll.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Ms. Ray?
Yes.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes.
And Mr. Gibson?
No. All right. With that, encourage everyone to go vote if you haven't voted yet, and we will be back on November 25th. Yeah.
Big break.
Thank you.